And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whichever the case may be on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition, and tonight it's a really, really special edition, as you're going to hear in the next 3 hours, of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn, when certainly on this show, anything can happen. Remember, our new catchphrase is everything, everywhere, all at once. There's all kinds of stuff to distract us in the so-called mainstream. There's trials, and there's tribulations, and there's union strikes, and there's, you know, politics endlessly. There's a national government about to shut down totally, absurdly, needlessly. All that stuff crowding all the news channels. And what we're going to talk about tonight on this show, and what we're going to do to enlist our audience as agents of change behind this incredible discovery, which literally we made only in the last couple of weeks. And thank goodness, because it's taken that much time to kind of put together a coherent presentation. What we're going to do tonight, I think, is going to, and if I say it modestly, it's because I kind of mean it, it's going to change history, because what we're going to announce and lay out and show you is so incredibly checkable, because nobody has to go to another planet. Nobody has to go to another website. Nobody has to go to another country. Everything we need to verify what we're going to talk about tonight is literally sitting in the United States of America in nitrogen coal vaults under Houston, and has been sitting there for about half a century, since Apollo 11 brought back the first samples, when the first two men to walk on the moon in the modern era kneeled safely to planet Earth, which was in the midsummer of 1969, July 1969. That, by the way, was the same moment that at JPL, where I happened to be for the landing, we encountered something so bizarre, because one of the official NASA employees, news manager under, I forget who the manager was at this point in time. Anyway, what I found so interesting even back then, and of course I find it doubly and triply, quadruply interesting now with the hindsight of, you know, decades, is that Bristow was squiring a guy dressed in one of those old Western dusters, or the kind of long coat that early Model T enthusiasts used to wear, because the roads were all dusty and traffic, wheel traffic, you know, cars, you know, Ford's first little cars, they stirred up an awful lot of dust on dusty roads. So you wore this great big coat, this long coat called a duster. I wonder why. Anyway, so this guy is at JPL being squired around the press room by one of the official NASA employees by way of JPL. Again, his name was Frank Bristow. And he was introducing him to all of the major correspondents for all of the major newspapers, television networks, just not just from the United States, but from literally all over the world. Because this, of course, was the press corps, 2000, give or take, that was covering the incredible landing on the moon and return of the first astronauts, while simultaneously there was an unmanned Mariner mission, Mariner 6 and 7, that were destined to fly by the planet Mars within a few thousand miles just a week or so after the Apollo 11 historic landing. So it was a very, very busy week at JPL, and I'm watching, knowing nothing of what I know now, and I'm watching Bristow squire around this guy dressed very, very odd, like something out of the last century, like a cowboy who had kind of wandered in, you know, out of some kind of a time slip, and he's handing everybody in the press room a little packet, and, you know, dutifully, after being patient, I got mine, and I open it up. And it's a little Mylar American flag meaning the colors are wrong, but they're printed not on white paper or white whatever, but on Mylar, silver Mylar. And there's a little write-up, like a one-page one-sheet, and it basically is claiming there in the NASA press room, with thousands of the world press gathered to witness part two of this 1969 summer drama, Land of the Moon, Fly by Mars, that kind of thing. He's handing to all the major press people a broadsheet which basically claims that what we're seeing or what we saw on live television from the moon, astronauts walking on the lunar surface in dimly, weirdly, ghostly black and white from a Seoul television camera set up outside the lunar module by Aldrin and Armstrong. This broadsheet and this guy with the duster is claiming that we never had gone to the moon, that everything we were seeing was taking place on a soundstage somewhere in Nevada. And for some reason, an official NASA spokesperson was squiring this guy around the press room, introducing him to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, you know, Nippon Television, all of the guys, as if it was a serious effort by somebody to basically discombobulate and discredit everything that NASA that afternoon was doing in getting ready for the return of the astronauts in the Pacific and the flyby of Mariner 6 and subsequently a few days later Mariner 7 past the planet Mars. It was bizarre then. It is triply bizarre now in hindsight, decades later. What was NASA doing? Planting the meme that we, the United States, in fact, never went to the moon. I'll tell you what they were doing. They were planting propaganda. They were planting a story. They were planting a whole way of looking at the moon and looking at the national achievement. And basically, in an era where the concept of fake news hadn't even been voiced, because that's decades in the future, they were spreading fake news that someone somewhere in the Big 9 or Big 12, whatever the upper ranking of the National Press Corps would have been then, because we only had three networks, remember. They were planting the meme that all of this was pointless because it all was being faked on a soundstage in Nevada. And that meme has been very, very, very hard to kill, even after decades of overwhelming evidence in the other direction. There is a residuum of people that apparently will believe anything but the truth, particularly if they have to raise a finger and kind of check things. No one knows how to check things anymore. We don't teach in school the process of figuring out the truth, and thereby will be our detriment. Anyway, tonight what we're going to do is to basically talk about and show you what it is that NASA from the get-go was very carefully preparing the groundwork to cover up. So even if someone across the years and decades stumbled over the truth, stumbled over the evidence, published it on something which back in 1969 was not even envisioned by most people in the culture, in the country, that is the internet, where anybody can kind of post almost anything, at least for a while. That distant day when democracy would rule and the most outrageous and absurd claims would be freely available for you to peruse and examine and think about and cogitate upon and try to decide, is this true? Is this, where's the evidence? Where's the backup? Where's the sourcing, et cetera, et cetera? All of that would come decades in the future as this guy literally was squired around the press room handing out his garbage to every reporter who had his hand out because it was news. Well, it's now 50-some years later, and tonight we're going to show you what it is that NASA has so assiduously worked so hard at so many different levels, including planting the meme that we never did any of this amazing stuff that they've been trying to keep secret for half a century. the idea that, in fact, there are not only ET artifacts on the moon, but as part of their collections, each of the missions, Apollo 11, Apollo 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, returned a total of almost 1,000 pounds of moon rocks and moon dust and moon dirt from the surface of our nearby world till, in fact, it came to pass that it was here on Earth, that it was accessible to everyone who would simply lift a finger and a spark of curiosity in trying to find out the truth. And the reason this is so important and has so many different implications is because once you get past remote sensing, once you get past photographs, which of course, you know, in this day and age with AI, nothing is impossible to fake. It just takes time, and not much time anymore because you've got commercial versions, ChatGPT. There's all kinds of background versions at the cutting edge of digital science and algorithms, which can accomplish in seconds what it used to take years to sift through in terms of terabytes of data. All of that is now before us, and it's kind of like a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it gives us access to extraordinary information. On the other hand, it raises the specter that everything we think is real, everything we look at, is at some level, if not totally, completely made up. In other words, discerning truth from lies has not gotten easier. It's gotten harder. And next week, when we do our AI show, our first of many, I'm sure, one of the questions I'm going to ask our expert is, well, there used to be a very interesting movie with Cary Grant about jewel robberies, and I think it was called To Catch a Thief. How do you catch a thief? Well, in that particular movie, which is quite good, you set a thief to catch a thief. You set someone who knows what the game is to catch someone trying to operate the game. Well, it's going to be the same with AI. The problem is that it's not there yet at the democratic level where ordinary citizens can take their favorite AI and set it to try to figure out if a given post or a given image or a given anything is the truth or is a lie. But it's coming, and we're going to talk about that in great detail next Saturday night. In the interim, I want you to all go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our URL. That's our homepage. Click on that. That will take you to tonight's show for Saturday, September 23rd, 2023. And you will click on tonight's banner, which says, Announcing the Enterprise Mission Avi Loeb Challenge. Click on that. That will take you to the guest page. And under the promo to listen to the show at the bottom of my little peroration there about tonight, click on my name where it says Fast Links to Items. That will take you to the inputs on the other side of Midnight's Radio with Pictures page. And you will see item number one. With all the other news making headlines all over the world, from strikes to trials to politics to disasters to all the stuff out there, one thing that has happened this week is probably going to live longer than any other news story. And that is that NASA, under the aegis of the Independent Study Team report on unidentified anomalous phenomena, they issued their report this week and even held a modest one-hour press conference, including the administrator, former Senator Bill Nelson, as the administrator of NASA, who said as part of the opening discussion of what this study had recommended to the agency that they have indeed set up a independent office at NASA headquarters to study anomalous phenomena. Now, by definition, science is, you know, it's anomalous. You study and try to learn a science of a new thing so you can understand how it works and how it impacts the world. So it's almost kind of redundant that NASA would set up an office to study anomalous phenomena. But of course, we know what they're really doing. They're going to be studying UFOs / UAP, which has changed its name many different times as a way to kind of backfill on the bad outlines and the bad intimations and implications of UFOs for many, many decades. What's interesting is that reporters, after they write, you know, UAP, they start writing UFO. So I don't think the name change is going to work. And frankly, I don't think it should, because historically, you know, UFOs are the moniker under which this extraordinary continuing anomaly continues to reign. So why am I singling out the NASA Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena report? Because the step, the two-step process, which was, you know, put in place a year ago, is that NASA would appoint this independent group of 16 or 17 independent scientists, world-class scientists, top of their field from all over the world under a NASA contract, and they would study the information and the data that was provided by the Pentagon and some other sources, and they would then come to a reasoned conclusion as to whether NASA should get involved in UAP / UFOs. And as Administrator Nelson said many, many times, he wants to take the field from speculation into science. Well, that's a very laudable objective. Now, what's really intriguing is they led off their report by saying that none of the current data indicates an extraterrestrial phenomenon, which, of course, is a lie. And even NASA should know better than to try to get away at the get-go with an outright lie, because everybody, of course, following these conversations and following these studies and following the politics knows it's a lie. So why are they playing the game this way? Well, I tried to ask Bassett, and he is hopelessly, and I say that with you know, tender care, he is hopelessly mired in the political process of Washington and thinks this is the only way that they can politically proceed. I will disagree, and when he's back on the show, we will have an interesting conversation. Because what you do when you make announcements that fly in the face of everything that people already know in their bones, in their gut, that the government has been lying about extraterrestrial phenomena for over 70 years, it's very hard to hoe a political line which basically says, don't admit anything. So NASA starts out by saying there's no evidence of extraterrestrials and or aliens. And then it proceeds to outline the rather interesting, you know, vanguard of a study, which at the end of that process, if they follow their own rules, will ultimately wind up with them having to change that initial take, that initial political statement. Because, of course, the evidence is all around us from all kinds of different sources, from incredibly credible military pilots with eyewitness reports to radar to all kinds of other, you know, digital media records, archives, film, eyewitness testimony going back, you know, even before Roswell. So ultimately, NASA, in this little dog and pony show game that they are playing dutifully to the Pentagon as a second as opposed to lead, they will ultimately, if they are honest, they will come to the conclusion that UAP exists. There are intelligent beings flitting around the Earth tonight whose destinations and origins we are quite in the dark about, because, again, just because someone says something doesn't mean that it's true. And just because an alien tells you something, to me, doesn't mean you should follow their lead and believe them without asking a lot of questions. So that's why many decades ago, I decided that UFOs, or the modern parlance, UAPs, was almost a fruitless study. It was kind of pointless to get mired in all the soap opera and all the weird things that have been happening and, you know, the food fights and the recriminations, you know, investigator against investigator against the government against flakes and crazies and all that. In other words, that to me looked even then, decades ago, like a bottomless pit, like a morass, like a cesspool. And nothing scientific could come out of this incredible, weird, you know, parlance of truth, lies, and videotape all meshed together. So I began to look at the possibility, after I was hit over the head with the Viking data on the face on Mars, I began to look at artifacts, at ruins, at architecture, at geometry, at mathematics, at the things that differentiate to any five-year-old a natural thing from an artificial thing. And I have said over the years that I will continue to do this because ruins stand still. And all you have to do is follow the current soap opera between disclosures and investigators with political agendas and agencies with agendas and the Pentagon with their agendas and NASA with a new agenda. And it's almost impossible to sort out, even with the best of intentions and the best process, the fake stuff from the real stuff. But as I've said over and over again, and we'll reiterate tonight, the thing that makes ancient ET ruins, starting with the moon and Mars and into the rest of the solar system, the thing that makes this different from the insane soap opera of ufology or UAPs or whatever, is that ruins stand still. And if you're really lucky, and in addition to ruins, you find a library, like scholars and archaeologists have for the last several centuries been looking in the Middle East or in the Mesoamerican jungles or anywhere on Earth for archaeology, they look for libraries, because you can't have a current human-level civilization without writing things down for the next generation. In the midst of all that, when NASA dumped this report on everyone a couple, 3 days ago, when I went to page 33, I found, as Hitchcock would say, the MacGuffin. Because on page 33, this is written by the independent study team that NASA, you know, contracted with a year ago, which came out this week with their final formal report. And I quote, "Currently planned or existing NASA missions can widen their scope to including searching for extraterrestrial technosignatures in planetary atmospheres, on planetary surfaces, or in near-Earth space. These searches generally wouldn't require changes in hardware or data acquisition, but may simply require new directions in data analysis." Let me repeat that. May simply require new directions in data analysis. So, translated from Washingtonese into English, what does that mean? It means that technosignatures, that is devices, artifacts, hardware, machines, computers, you know, lunches, anything left by an extraterrestrial could show up in a planetary search as a technosignature. In other words, an object, an artifact uniquely only produced by a technological civilization, and in this case, by an extraterrestrial one. And they include on planetary surfaces. Well, think about it. If, as opposed to jumping into UFOs and things that go bump in the night and lights in the sky and cell phone videos and all the other crap that they're going to have to go through to try to find a signal, if NASA only looks at its own calibrated terabytes of images acquired over decades of the moons, Mars, moons of Saturn, moons of Jupiter, Mercury, clouds of Venus, everywhere we have sent spacecraft, or NASA has sent spacecraft, all across the solar system. If they simply develop a protocol to, with AI and machine learning, which of course can look through millions of images much quicker than a room full of human beings, if they simply program the right algorithms to look for geometry of artificiality on their own database, the dawning of a new age will come. Well, when Nelson announced at the press conference that NASA would be heavily using AI and machine learning, I knew that something had been set up correctly to where now you need to merely, in this new office, this UAP office at NASA headquarters, you merely need to fit in the data, and out will come overwhelming evidence of an extraterrestrial civilization, or maybe even more than one, because what we're looking at, of course, seems to be different epochs who had different levels of technology. And again, that will be available and readily recognizable by an AI or a machine learning program. All NASA has to do is to formally announce that this is what they're going to do in terms of searching their own database, and the game will be over. Because any true neutral AI programmed to look for the geometric signatures of artificiality amid the terabytes of photographic information that NASA has acquired all across the solar system in the last 50 years, all they have to do is publish that and then have it peer-reviewed by outside experts, outside AI, outside panels, and bingo, we will have won. However, there's a bit of a bureaucratic minefield between that goal and where we are tonight. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce something totally brand new, totally off the wall. And to do that, I need to kind of introduce one of our members, Robert Morningstar, because frankly, without Robert's asking what appeared to be a very, very simple question, we would not be having this show tonight. So let me do the setup, and then when we come back from the break, I'll give you, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. I sent around a NASA document, a preliminary science report from Apollo 16, about 2 weeks ago. And I just linked to the NASA site where all this literature is carefully stored and is carefully archived. When I sent it around, the one person who responded was Robert, and he said to me very innocently, "Well, what is that thing on the cover? Why should I be looking at that?" And I hadn't really looked at the cover, so I did, and lo and behold, it turned out that it was a black and white image of what's called a thin section, which is a slice of a rock. And we'll go through how this is all done when we come back from the break. But it was in black and white and not in color. And what's so interesting is that Robert, even in black and white, recognized there was something weird about it. And when we come back, I'll tell you what the weirdness was and what led to our incredible discovery and tonight's program. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, September 23rd, 2023. Two threes. Interesting. I hadn't noticed that before. Anyway, so Robert asked me this very simple question, and I gave him the standard NASA answer, which is that these were photogeological thin sections. When geologists get rocks here on Earth, or you go to the moon and you pick up rocks and bring them back, one of the ways they are analyzed, in fact, if we go to the other side of midnight.com, we can actually see an item number 4. I'll get back to 3 in a minute. What a thin section looks like. This is a meteorite being held in the gloved hands of a technician at NASA. And it was picked up somewhere, either in the Antarctic or maybe in the Sahara Desert, whatever. When these objects, these extraterrestrial messengers, are brought back to NASA by various teams, they are sliced with diamond saws into very, very, very thin sections. And then those thin sections, if they're thin enough, the minerals in the rock literally are transparent. They refract light. They polarize light. We've talked about polarization a lot lately. And these are tools that are used on a microscope stage to look at the rock and to identify crystals and minerals and assemblages of minerals, et cetera, et cetera. So I gave Robert the NASA answer. This is a black and white of a thin section of one of the Apollo 16 lunar rocks, which had been posted as part of the cover of this report. And then I looked at it a little closer and I thought, wait a minute, that's the NASA answer. But what I was seeing, and I hadn't looked at it in years, in fact, I must confess I never really looked at any of these thin sections because, you know, you've seen one stained glass window looking thin section crystal, you've seen them all, or at least if you're not a geologist, they kind of all look alike. But I went looking for the color version of the cover of this Apollo 16 report. And it was very hard to find because they're not labeled very clearly. And I just grabbed another one by random chance. And I brought it into, imaging programs, downloaded it, brought it in, looked at it, and went, oh, my God. Because there, right in front of me, if I've been looking at any of these images from thin sections of the moon rocks brought back from Apollo, this game would have been over decades ago, because in those thin sections that I'm posting tonight, starting with item number 5, and then 6, 7, 8, those 5, 6, 7, 8, look at them carefully, take them into an imaging program, look at them really carefully. They appear to be a cross-section in a matrix of various stages of extraterrestrial machines. Some of them are fragments. Those would be bigger machines. Some of them have obviously been cut in two by the diamond saws used to cut apart the rock. Remember, these are rocks from Apollo 16, brought back by the Apollo 16 astronauts, John Young, who was the commander of that mission. And they were sliced and analyzed in Houston at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. Samples were sent all over the world to thousands of consulting scientists in laboratories and universities, literally all around the planet. These samples were not kept quietly in Houston. So as I looked at the first color thin section, and I could see not only fragments of bigger machines, but what looked to be like little tiny nano machines, fully assembled nano technology, obviously of an extraordinarily advanced culture, left in the regolith on the moon, smashed together. You're going to hear a term tonight called breccias. Breccias are most of what the moon rocks are composed of. What's a breccia? It's basically a smashed together rock created by the pressures of meteor impacts and shock waves far away. And what it does is it smashes up the regolith, which is the lunar soil. It smashes pieces of other rock that has been fragmented by previous impacts together to create a new rock called a breccia. And most of the rocks that were picked up by the Apollo astronauts were these smashed together moon rocks created by older rocks, which had been broken apart by endless millions, if not billions, of years of meteor impact on the airless lunar surface. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at cross sections of smashed up breccia moon rocks brought back by the astronauts. And if you look very carefully at item number 4, let me just make sure that I've got the right item up here. Okay. Item number 4. Yep. Item number 5. Yeah. That is what a thin section of these particular Apollo 16 moon rock, whose number I don't even have. This has been put together so speedily in the last 2 weeks. When you look at it in close-up, like if you look at item number 6, which is a close-up of number 5, you will see what appears to be incredible manufactured multi-dimensional geometry. Not once, not twice, but again and again and again, all over the thin section covered. It's basically like a millimeter or less of actual moon rock as a thin section. So then you go to number 7. And there in the upper left-hand corner, you see a stunning object, an artifact, something that does not belong in a vaporized or smashed together moon rock. In fact, at the bottom left, you can see one of these like rods, three-dimensional rods, looking like some kind of framework. And you can see it trailing off against that white background, which appears to be a melted wire. You can see the wire actually trailing off. Why would it be melted? Because look at all the little white things all over the image. Those are objects cut in half by the diamond saw, and the diamond saw creates heat of friction. And so because it was somewhere between the saw and that little white oval, the little wire literally melted from the friction of the saw. And there you can see it. Well, you can look at all the other examples. We'll go through some of this in more detail as we go through our various discussions with our panel members. Tonight, we've got John Brandenburg, who, of course, is a nuclear plasma physicist, been involved in several major NASA efforts and DOD efforts, including the Clementine mission to send an unmanned robotic spacecraft on a military mission back in 1992 to the moon. He was part of our independent Mars investigation. That's how John and I first met. I asked him way back when if certain craters on the moon could be the imprint of nuclear weaponry, you know, bombs and whatever, and what others might be caused by particle beams or lasers. And that was the beginning of an incredibly long and fruitful conversation and friendship stretching now over decades. So when I looked at all this, one of the first people I wanted to talk to about it was John Brandenburg. So without further ado, John, welcome to the other side of midnight, and let's get right into what I wanted you to talk about, which is something very parallel to our discovery, which is Avi Loeb's odyssey to the South Pacific and his discovery through magnetic raking at the bottom of the South Pacific Ocean, like, you know, 2 miles or something down, of objects, melted objects, which he analyzed in terms of their nuclear and chemical structure as being a very weird non-meteoritic assemblage of elements, which you don't normally see in solar system sampling from all over, including the moon, including meteorites, including earth rocks, et cetera, et cetera. So that was how we kind of began our conversation. It turns out that this week you have a scientific paper which has been published out of India addressing, in fact, this particular problem. So let's start there. How have you been following Loeb's expedition, and what are your conclusions from what Loeb found? Because frankly, the title of tonight's show, The Avi Loeb Challenge, we are challenging Dr. Loeb to apply the same technologies he's applied to what he found under the South Pacific to the lunar samples resident in Houston, about 840 pounds of rock and soil and regolith and fines, as they're called. If he applies even 1/1000th of the diligence he has shown in his South Pacific expedition, we will have an answer within days. Are there in fact micro machines and technological fragments immersed, embedded in the matrix of the Brescia moon rocks the Apollo astronauts returned over 50 years ago to Earth? John?
Yes, yes. Great pleasure and honor to be on your show, Richard. And yes, I have been following Avi Loeb's work for several years now, because he began with this, looking at this 10 to 1 length to width
Oumuamua
asteroid, that came cruising out of the sun. It approached from the sun side, and he noted several things about it, that it was the exact average velocity for the surrounding stars, so you couldn't figure out which way it came from, which star it came from. It came from the sun side, and then we only detected it once it had scooted past the Earth. And when they started interrogating it with laser radar beams, it sped up to get out of the solar system to make a getaway. Pretty suspicious. And he immediately said this was no asteroid and it was no comet.
John,
said,
John, hang on, hang on.
An interstellar probe by somebody.
Hang on, hang on. This was the fall in October of, I believe,
right,
2017.
And now he has very much been looking for other evidence that we are being probed by people in some interstellar power. And he's found evidence of this in this meteor that came in, or let's call it an off.
Well, hang on. Let's jump ahead here. I want to say on the record that on this show, I was the first to ever say that Oumuamua was an interstellar intelligently designed craft.
That's a very good thing that you said that.
And Loeb followed that, but he followed it looking for kind of current mainstream explanations. I think now he's fastened on the idea it might be a solar sail, and I think it's something much more advanced.
I think it was a much more advanced device, and a solar sail does not come in from interstellar space like this thing did and leave.
Well, what's really weird is it was like it was parked in the path of the solar system, so we walked up on it like it was not moving, and it was basically the encounter velocity of us orbiting the galaxy and it sitting almost motionless that resulted in the velocities that were observed that made it clear it was an interstellar object, the first ever known.
Yeah, that's right. And he's been attracted a great deal of hostility from the community because, you know, we've been, academia is dependent on grants from NASA and the National Science Foundation, and they don't want any discussion of any extraterrestrials at all. I'm sorry, they don't.
Well, they will be overwhelmed by reality. Anyway, so
yes.
So Loeb
yes.
has been on this kind of interesting mission, self-appointed.
Yes, and, he was threatened with being fired, even though he's a tenured. He was head of the department, and he says, "Good, fire me. I'm tired of doing all this stupid paperwork as head of the department." he couldn't be actually fired from the university because he's got tenure, and. You also must realize that the Israeli defense chief, you know, he is Israeli. He grew up in Israel, and the defense chief who is in charge of space has said not only are there extraterrestrials out there, but the U.S. government has a treaty with them, a secret treaty of some sort. And I believe that was said in 2014.
You know what bothers me, John, is that someone of that caliber with that position in the Israeli Defense Force, and given the amount of money we spend, you know, we send to Israel every year, it's a huge political impact on American politics. The fact that someone high up in the Israeli government could say something like that, and nobody in the mainstream repeats it or asks him, "What the hell do you mean?"
It's
very frustrating because it's like, there are certain things, by agreement, someone has decided we are not supposed to know, which goes back to artifacts, because I find it
yes.
much easier to unveil artifacts than these ET encounters with UFOs, space people, spaceships, and all that. Remember, there's been this whole hue and cry now since that congressional hearing a few weeks ago, where one of the witnesses talked about alien spaceships the government has, our government,
yes.
and alien
yes.
bodies and all that. The difference between what we're announcing tonight and any of this other stuff is, by law, the stuff we're announcing tonight must be available for independent scientific study. So if Avi Loeb wants to really go down in history as the guy who proved that we're not alone, there's 842 pounds of stuff sitting in Houston just waiting for him to knock on the door.
Well, you know, the science fiction, you know, a science fiction era scenario that extraterrestrials had bases on the moon appeared for the first time in 1957 in the movie Mysterians, the same people who brought you the Godzilla movies.
Hmm.
You know, they had... they had UFO abductions of these hot Japanese girls, and that got everybody interested. And they also had, you know, alien bases on the moon, and finally one near Mount Fuji, which, you know, caused a very serious reaction by the world's powers.
So are you saying that through their media, the Japanese were in on the secret and they were trying to kind of blow the lid off?
It's as if somebody gave them that script, you know, out of Langley in Virginia. I mean, we were still heavily involved in the Japanese government in 1947. It was only a few years.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Two years after... I mean, this is 1957, so it was 12 years after, 57. Anyway, it was about, 12 years after World War II was over. I mean, the ruins in Tokyo were still smoking. And the United States basically advised the Japanese government on just about everything it did. When they could use the bathroom. And,
so you're saying we don't have a lot of time if you can only spend another 10 minutes with us.
Let's just say that idea has been around for a long time, along with UFO abductions and even animal mutilations. That was in the thing with James Arness, the original 1955 ET movie, based on Who Goes There. So anyway, just to cut to the chase, the idea that anybody bothering us or trying to investigate us would put up bases on the moon is a very standard science fiction scenario, which of course could have been planted by the government, who knows. And that if there had been those sorts of structures on the moon, and let's just say, well, everything on the moon is preserved. The rocks are, close to 4 billion years old, 4.5 billion years old.
Well, when you say preserve, remember the operative process on the moon is smash and grab.
Absolutely, smash and grab. I mean, people are looking at the moon all the time, and they find fireballs on the lunar surface from asteroid impacts all the time. I mean, asteroids don't burn up in the atmosphere. On the moon, it doesn't have one. So they just crash into the surface, and they make these nice bright sparks. So, and there's micrometeor. For every meteorite you see, there's a million specks of dust that crash into the moon. So even if you built a structure and then abandon it, it would get hammered to pieces in a million years.
And then the pieces are redistributed and redistributed and redistributed. I keep kicking myself that I didn't think of this decades ago, because I never imagined that the temperatures and pressures would allow for actual individual pieces. And again, if you look at my samples, 5, 6, 7, mm-hmm. and 8, as we'll get to when we bring the other panelists on, there's tons of machine-like looking things. John, when you look at this, what do you think of?
I've looked at them. Some of them look quite fascinating. They look like fragments of technology. I will freely say that.
Okay, so, all right, but see, that's
in my own science fiction novel about the collapse of the UFO cover-up, I had all these bases on the moon, and some of them had changed hands quite violently.
Okay, for people that have no idea how we're going to go from presenting these images tonight to where we get real science, we need to walk through what Loeb did with his samples. Because after he published that Oumuamua was probably artificial, He's the second guy, I'm the first, and he came out with a whole bunch of evidence. We have totally different evidence, but it's so complementary. He then turned his idea to our attention to UFOs or UAP,
an object that came in at interstellar velocities.
Well, hang on. I haven't done with the setup. He set up this thing at Harvard called Project Galileo, and he's been funded by DOD and NASA money, and he started looking at setting up like what Alan Hynek did decades ago from Northwestern, Northeastern, he would set up cameras. That was Project Galileo. And then he tripped over this 2014 Defense Department report. Because remember, we have radar probing the solar system in all directions.
Well, we have satellites watching.
And we have satellites looking down at the Earth and all that. The DOD published in 2014 that a meteor, an object obviously of interstellar origin because it smacked into the Earth in excess of escape velocity from the sun at this distance, had been tracked all the way through initial high altitudes down to the surface, and then it dumped itself in the ocean. So there was a pretty good area Loeb got intrigued with, because what he wanted to do was to somehow get money, get a submersible down to the ocean floor, drag, some kind of a sled around looking for fragments. Turns out that he was looking for magnetic fragments. So if you drag...
It's very easy to collect stuff that
way. Yeah, exactly. And when he brought it up, he had something so unusual in terms of elemental and isotopic content that he published all over the world in major media without waiting for peer review and papers and all that he'd found an interstellar artifact that had disintegrated in Earth's atmosphere, and he'd recovered some samples.
I've analyzed it. That was no meteorite.
Hang on. That's where the fun begins, because just because something is from outer space doesn't make it extraterrestrial. Just because something is interstellar doesn't make it extraterrestrial, i.e. artificial. But you looked at the composition of
yes.
the objects that Loeb recovered, and you have come to a startling, stunning, amazing scientific conclusion. Have
yes.
at it.
Okay. Well, the first thing you do is you look at the natural abundance of stuff in the solar system, and which matches the spectra of nearby stars. So that's fairly standard. A relative abundance of elements, not the actual isotopes. That's more detailed. But anyway, you look at that, and you look at the meteorites that we find generally have that relative abundance of minerals, of elements. And this thing is completely alien. It looks, in fact, like melted aerospace alloy. It's got a lot of titanium and aluminum in it, and it's got iron, because, of course, it was magnetic, so they picked up stuff that was magnetic. But it has almost no nickel in it. Nickel and iron are always associated in meteorites, about 10 to 1, roughly 10% nickel for every, of the iron nickel arrangement. Okay, then you look even deeper, you notice it's full of beryllium, lithium, uranium, and also
that's
thorium.
A bizarre combo.
Well, these are three very rare elements. One is very heavy, that's uranium. And then the other two are very, very unfavored. The universe likes to make helium from hydrogen, and then it skips over lithium and beryllium. It hardly makes any of that at all. Then it makes a lot of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen. But this thing is full of beryllium and lithium and uranium, three very rare elements, except if you have a melted thermonuclear weapon.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, my God, John. Wait, you mean someone sent us a nuke from interstellar
yes.
space?
I mean,
and it didn't go off?
Little friend. Yes.
It obviously didn't go off, so it burned up in the atmosphere.
It burned up in the atmosphere. Now, the best face you can put on this, the best, is that this was a failed Orion-type interstellar probe propelled by thermonuclear charges.
Okay, hang on a sec. We're up against John, we're up against
yeah.
the top of the hour, so I'm going to hold you over.
Okay.
You're on the other side of midnight. We're undergoing an extraordinary kind of blow-by-blow of what happened back in 2014, which was years before Oumuamua showed up.
Yes.
You're on the other side of midnight. My first guest tonight, John Brandenburg, he will complete the story of why he thinks, from Loeb's published materials assessment, that what smacked into the Earth's atmosphere in excess of solar system escape velocity, meaning it came from beyond the solar system, was in fact a manufactured, recognizable thermonuclear device or weapon that miraculously, when it hit the atmosphere, didn't go off. And it couldn't be from anybody here, because it was moving faster than 30 miles per second. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. When we return, John will complete the rest of the story.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, the 23rd of September, 2023. 23s, wasn't it? Who was the writer who thought 23 was a kind of a communication code to Sirius? I know someone's pricking up their ears at that. Anyway, so John has laid before us an extraordinary hypothesis backed up by the Abbey Loeb data, which is that someone for Christmas sent us a thermonuclear weapon, and for some reason it didn't explode, and the only people that would know this would be those who could spend enough money to go and drag the bottom of the ocean floor off Indonesia and New Guinea and come up with samples that John can look at and say, wait a minute, nobody creates that unless. John, pick it up.
Yeah, well, for one thing, I'm certain that people in Abbey Loeb's group know exactly what they were looking at.
Well, don't you think the DOD? Hang on. Don't you think the DOD was funding him quietly so that he could be the point man to go and look and recover this stuff, given that he is out there? In other words, it's wheels within wheels within wheels. Nobody's telling us the truth.
Anyone who can look on Wikipedia and see the design of a thermonuclear weapon can figure this out. I mean, you look at the design, you just look on Wikipedia, it's got a diagram of a nuclear weapon. It's full of beryllium, lithium, and uranium. And these are three very rare elements in nature, but you combine them together and they make a rare thing, a thermonuclear, let's just call it a device. For right now, if you want to propel a spacecraft to near the speed of light for interstellar travel and do it at a fairly low, some kind of technology that we could even do ourselves, then you do a Project Orion type nuclear charge propelled vehicle. And it's as if somebody had aimed this probe at the Earth from interstellar somewhere else, some other star system, and it fell in. It basically rendezvoused with the sun, the solar system, got into the same rest frame as the sun, and then fell inward towards the Earth. And it was supposed to fire braking charges, which would have been nuclear explosions. To slow down and go into orbit around the Earth, but whoever ran it, let's put the best possible face on this. They decided just to let it burn up in the atmosphere instead, because they detected that the human race was here.
Wait. Hang on. Let me. Given that we have a whole bunch of other signatures, that somebody out there has been palling around here for a very long time. Do you really think this was some naive, pre-war civilization using the best of their technology to send a ship between the stars? Or was it a weapon sent deliberately to our DOD, fused so it would not explode, but if it was recovered, everybody knew it was a weapon because it was a challenge to the current political directions of what's going on Earth. In other words, it's basically blackmail. Like, if you keep going, could do even worse.
That is certainly a possible scenario.
And by not letting it...
I call this a fig leaf interpretation. I'm putting a fig leaf over the...
Well, we can't really speculate about anything because we have no data other than
I know. We have a thing that was melted and then disintegrated in the atmosphere after coming in at very high speed. It was very tough, by the way. The hull of this thing was made of very tough heat-resistant alloy. And that was full of aluminum and titanium.
Well, it obviously had some kind of heat shield, otherwise it wouldn't have survived at all, right?
Well, yes, and it was the toughest thing they'd ever seen come in because it came in so fast and yet survived so long to low altitudes before melting and then breaking up into a shower of droplets over the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, it almost seems to me, John, like a gift. And we could speculate all night, and we don't have all night.
When you bring in intelligence and the interaction of civilization, the possibilities become just myriad. The astronomical number of possibilities.
Okay, if you want to go to check out John's items for real, which means it's a written report, there are two items published under John's section.
It's a preprint. It's been accepted as a scientific journal.
Okay, so item number one is a PDF that John created on his hypothesis that this was a nuclear weapon that did not explode, but we know it from the signature of the materials, which are
it's a fig leaf, but I call it a device.
Yeah, well, okay. And item number two is an actual link to the paper, which is being published even as we speak by a mainstream Indian scientific journal, right?
Yes.
They're on a roll, Chandrayaan.
Oh no! The link I sent you was the earlier article about the Mars Holocaust. I haven't gotten the link for the Indian scientific.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm sorry. They just haven't. We've gotten everything all tied up with a ribbon on it, but they haven't sent me the link to the saying the article's been published. Here's the link to it.
Well, let me close the loop here then, because what differentiates our announcement tonight of ET machines and fragments in the matrix of all these rocks, almost 1,000 pounds of samples brought back by the astronauts sitting here on Earth tonight under a civilian space agency. There's no legal pretense, once you know what's in that vault, that they can keep it secret. What I want to do is I want to marry Loeb's technology, his technique, which he used to analyze the elemental composition of this bizarre interstellar object, weapon, whatever, apply the same technology in a laboratory to different random samples from the Apollo cache. Remember, almost 1,000 pounds, sliced this rock, that rock, that rock over there, see what's inside, and then apply the same ion beam micro sampling technology, which is literally nanometers in scale, to turn up what the composition is in terms of elements, metals, plastics, whatever, of these apparent-looking machines, because that will tell us for pennies, what this stuff is made of if it's manufactured, and it might even give us some clues as to the nature of the devices themselves and their end use. It's all within grasp tonight if Abby Loeb, as part of his journey, will go from collecting materials under the Pacific Ocean to making a visit to Houston and applying the same technology to the 842 pounds of priceless samples returned to Earth, because there's not just rocks in those samples. There's real, incredibly ancient ET technology.
Oh, I think you're very, very much correct. I think that this is a very plausible interpretation of some of the fragments you see in your in these slices, and we ought to be investigating that. There could be a million years worth of technology that was built, abandoned, wrecked by meteors, scattered all over the lunar surface, and just became part of the lunar regolith. And
see,
and
what I hadn't, well, John,
spaceships to you know, abandoned domes.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes, exactly.
All the science fiction scenario, and because you know, well, the reason, by the way, Earth is in the center of a galactic void. We actually own Boardwalk and Park Place, believe it. And this could account by why we seem to get so many tourists, reportedly. But
right.
Anyway, I think we may have been discovered by some other less advanced species than the other ones. I don't, who knows? Who knows?
Well, that's why I don't want to do a lot of speculating tonight, because we don't have to. We can actually
right.
figure
I'll
this
tell you,
out.
I'll tell you what UAP stands for, though. It means you are played. I mean, you are played for a fool.
Okay, that's one way of putting it.
Absolutely.
Hey,
let me the name from UFO to UAP.
Let me talk about another mission.
Would not make a connections to the UFO cover-up.
Yeah. John, let me talk about another mission that kind of dovetails to what we're talking about tonight.
Okay, very good.
Because literally it's Saturday night, it's the 23rd, tomorrow the 24th, tomorrow the NASA OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, the return capsule, bringing about a pound, give or take, of samples from the asteroid Bennu, which looks incredibly weird geometrically, is going to enter the skies of continental United States over Utah, will come into the atmosphere, will land in some Utah desert, will be picked up by a team ferried there by helicopter, will be then sent to the extension of the old Lunar Receiving Laboratory in Houston, where the moon rocks were analyzed decades ago and are still being analyzed. And this new material, which is, as I said, about a pound of very finely divided stuff. Looks
yeah,
like
they
little rocks.
Up a bunch of stuff from the surface.
Oh, a tremendous amount. And I'm going to bet dollars to Navy beans that in among that 1 pound of stuff, there is the same kind of micro machinery that we found in the rocks the astronauts brought
back
from the
moon. I'll tell you what I think they're going to find in there. It's CI carbonaceous chondrites, which are for Mars, by the way.
Well, we will both see who's right. The point
we'll
is
both
that
see who's right.
That
I
that,
see.
That,
I'll put a nickel on that wager.
Okay, well, I can probably do better than that. But anyway, the point is that tomorrow, sometime during the day, I'm not exactly sure whether it's morning or afternoon, but this sample return from the Bennu asteroid, which has been a mission ongoing since 2022 when they picked up the samples of the asteroid, it'll be back on Earth. It will be analyzable by all the incredible array of extraordinarily sophisticated technology, which literally can look at the nanometer scale, things that are a billionth of a meter, which is about 3 feet, as the same kind of technology that Loeb used on his samples. This kind of technology should be applied both to the Bennu samples coming in tomorrow and the 840 pounds of moon rocks that have been on Earth for over half a century. And believe me, if this is done properly and in public, the answer is going to be, we are not alone. History takes a huge leap forward. Now, if Loeb does not pick up the challenge, I'm going to be very intrigued with what his excuses for not taking a look turn out to be. Because if he doesn't do it, we can put together another team, and under law, NASA will have to provide the samples for an accredited team looking with these state-of-the-art tools.
They have some loophole. You know, there's
there is no loophole. There is no
evidence.
Loophole. No, there is
they
none.
They have a whole department in the government to confiscate extraordinary evidence. It's all locked in a warehouse.
Yeah, but that's
the
then
government.
And this is now. You know, if you're living back then, yeah, we'll never make any progress. We're making all kinds of progress. It's just not linear. And I guarantee you it's not going to come from the UFO crazies. It's going to come from looking at artifacts NASA returned a half century ago. And what I don't understand, John, I mean, you've been part of the community for decades.
Yeah.
How if you're a geologist in Kuala Lumpur or in South Korea or in Japan, and you analyze this stuff and you find what you and I agree is there, and you don't report it, how do you get away with not announcing something so astonishing in a sample that came directly through the paper trail and the chain of custody from NASA?
There's a great deal of herd thinking in science. I'm sorry to break it to you, Richard. I asked a British guy, they'd found organic materials in a Mars meteorite. And I said, well, that was 2 years ago. Why haven't you found any more? And he said, we were afraid to find any more because we got so much hostility when we announced our first findings, he said. And so...
But hang on. Now NASA has officially set up a bureaucracy looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, either as vehicles or as chemistry or as little machines in the rocks brought home from the moon. There's no way with this political backdrop that they can avoid the truth for much longer because we're going to push like crazy.
Things are changing. The whole thing is falling apart. We're going through the second Copernican revolution, you know, where we're going to wake up one morning and realize, oh, my God, we're not the center of the biological universe after all. And so it's I do agree with you. I guess I'm a little bit cynical after my experiences, especially after, you know. Well,
do you want to talk about...
You organized the independent Mars investigation team, and I'm so glad that you asked me to be a part of that. It changed my life for the better. And
well, as Humphrey Bogart said in Casablanca, it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
There you go, Richard. No, it just, you made the face on Mars as well known as the face of Washington on the dollar bill, and that was a big accomplishment.
Well, that was just foreplay. This stuff you see on the screen, this is where the action is. And we have one protagonist, Abby Loeb. Hey, I want to bring some other members of our panel.
Yeah, bring on Bob Morningstar.
Well, I want to actually start with Andrew. Because Andrew Curry
Thank you, John.
And Andrew Curry is not a scientist, he's an artist, but he is recognizably proficient in seeing geometry and shapes.
Oh,
Andrew,
very good.
What was your first take when you looked at these micro photographs?
Well, if you zoom in really close, there's a couple things I want to get off here, off my chest. There's symmetry and there is organization. And I say that not only by looking at it, but when I compared it to, thin slices or whatever of crystal stuff. The crystal is, sometimes it looks peculiar and strange, like things here on Earth, but it's not to the degree of organization that the samples that you're putting out there, Richard, are. And look, this is, if I really went in and spent the time to go into the details, I could pull stuff out. And I didn't have time today. I'm sorry about that. I promised you, Richard, and I couldn't.
It's all right.
But but there are, you know, we're seeing things like wires, John, like possibly even wires in this stuff.
I know. I've looked at the pictures, and some of the stuff looks very much like broken up microtechnology.
Yeah, and there's even one of our members here, Ron Gerbron, he said it reminded him of an episode, I think it was Stargate
SG-1.
Yeah, and Richard, do you want to explain what Ron saw?
Well, why don't we bring on Ron? Ron Gerbron, are you with us, Ron? Is Ron with us? I think I see him.
He is there.
I think I see him, yeah. Ron, pick up.
He's seen but not heard.
Oh, too bad.
I'm on muting. You know how I am with phones.
All right, you've been muted.
So, Ron, speak up.
Okay, the most recent and evil, well, not evil, foe that the Stargate crew faced was a bunch of self-replicating nanobots.
Sure.
Well, they called them replicants.
Uh-huh.
And that thing that is so prominent in Richard's prime sample there, the first time I looked at it, I said, this looks like a replicator tile.
Are we looking at 7 or 6?
I can't look at the screen right now.
I think it's probably 7. Yeah. The one that has the wires and the cross-hatching and all that?
Yeah, that was the first thing you sent me, the picture number one you sent me. This is John.
Yeah.
And that is quite impressive.
Well, but see, I only had time to look at 2 or 3 samples out of literally thousands of rocks that NASA has thin sectioned over the years and posted their images all over the NASA headquarters, various Apollo mission websites. So between now and the next time we do a show like this, I will find more. I'll do comparisons showing what ordinary thin sections of rocks on Earth, crystalline rocks, look like. I mean, there's basically just 3 types of rocks. There's igneous, which is melted. There is sedimentary rocks, which form on Earth underwater. And then there's conglomerates, which are bigger chunks of rock formed underwater. But on the moon, you've got what are called these brushes, where every impact, because of the shock and the thermal stress of something coming in at hypervelocity, creates a crater, creates all kinds of debris, welds debris from totally disparate sources together as kind of like synthetic rocks. And that was the majority of the material the astronauts brought home. And as John said over and over again, if you've got a technology covering a large part of the moon, and you got a few million years to play with, by the time you get the brushes, we now know, you're looking at them on the screen, there could be bits and pieces of technology from anywhere on the moon.
From 15 different species.
Exactly. And from a billion years of time. I mean, this is such a breakthrough. English almost fails me to properly context tonight what this show represents.
And why
Avi Loeb, let me finish, would be dumb not to take the lead on this, given that we're offering it to him, to follow up on his splendid work in the South Pacific and simply bring in the revolution in a way that is absolutely quintessentially scientific through and through, no need to speculate at all.
Well, and I'll mention to you that this stuff would not survive on Earth because of all the water.
Oh, it would be oxidized totally to nothing.
You know, there's so much geologic activity in water, especially inundation by water and erosion and stuff. You wouldn't have this stuff on if there was anything like this that fell into the Earth's environment from space. It would be gone in 1,000 years. On the moon, though, everything is preserved.
Yep. And remember, we've got pieces coming back to Earth tonight from Bennu, and I guarantee you there could be 1 or 2 of those weird things in that sample. A pound is stunning.
The Japanese, you realize, also did a asteroid return, so they have some asteroid material, and their asteroid actually crossed the orbit of Mars, too. It spent a lot of time out by Mars. So it was coated with carbonaceous chondrites, which was a big surprise to them.
Okay, we've got a lot of people on the panel tonight, so let's bring on Robert Morningstar. And by the way, everybody's bios are available where it says under the promo tonight, fast links to bios. John's is there, Ron's, Andrew's, Ruggiero's, Keith, David, Robert, Laura, and Barbara. So let's bring let me do this.
Richard,
yeah,
can I interject just for
yeah.
I really want to ask John a question. I know we're 5 minutes to the end of the half hour, and I know John.
Ask away.
Yeah, John, listen, we did a little study, or I did a little study, on a lot of the staff for NASA in regards to their Curiosity mission, you know, basically the Mars rover missions that were going on. And these young people, a lot of them are young. There's a mixture of ages. But a lot of the younger ones, the ones sort of in their 20s, 30s, go on in their bios about, wow, you know, I grew up on Star Trek and this and that. And you know, when I'm really outgoing, I travel. And then they're just clicking a picture and not seeing anything.
Well, they recruit people who have, like, to drive rovers who have been driving in L.A. for 5 years. If they see a burning car next to the freeway with a person in a gorilla suit waving for help, they just keep driving. And that's the kind of people they hire to, you know, drive the rovers on Mars and to look at the data. And these people – by the way, I was a young graduate student at one point. I was told the world is flat and stay away from the edges, basically. And I said, yes, sir, please sign my PhD thesis so I can get up.
So you're basically saying it's groupthink. I think it's a little more pernicious. I'm frankly.
Oh, it's more pernicious than just groupthink.
Well, I think it's mind control. I think it's a technology alive and well and used very sparingly, but in critical key situations, like a whole bunch of, you know, Star Trek grad students at JPL saying, oh, my God, look at that machine. Look at that, you know, whatever. None of them are doing what would be expected. None.
No, and they know better than to do it.
If a whole bunch of them decided to hold a press conference, there's not a damn thing that anybody could do. Not a damn thing.
They could fire all of them.
So, John, last thing, and I know we're getting close to that.
Sorry, yes.
And I don't want to take up Robert's time when we come back. But we just talked about NASA coming back from Bennu. You just spoke about the Japanese mission that's bringing scrapings of, we know what that's not an asteroid. We know that geometric thing is a thing, a space platform or a spaceship or, you know, it's just a derelict.
Sure.
What is it going to take for the straw to break the camel's back? Like, what is it going to take? When, I mean, how much evidence is someone going to leak this? Richard's
Andrew, remember, John is very cynical. I'm much more, you know, bullish.
I'm not cynical. I'm just a little jaded. That's all.
But what would it take if we have just insurmountable evidence? I mean, you can't look past this stuff forever, or can we?
Well, in my novel about the collapse of the UFO cover-up, some ranchers finally bring down a flying saucer trying to take one of their cows for mutilation. And the government sends troops to try and recover it, and they run into a bunch of trigger-happy cowboys, and the cowboys win the gun battle, and the UFO cover-up then has only hours to live after that. That's what happens in my novel.
Tell them the name of the novel.
Morningstar Pass, The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up. It's by coincidence, it sounds like Robert Morningstar inspired it. Actually, it was a little town in Virginia called Morningstar that I stumbled across.
Yeah.
So, but anyway,
it's a great name.
What's that?
I'll never forget. That's how we met, when I came out from undercover in the UFO.
Okay, guys, we are at the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
My guests this morning are John Brandenburg and a cast to numerous dimension. They're all listed on the website. You can find their bios. We're going to get right back to our conversation right after this small message from the other side of midnight. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, the 23rd of September of 2023. We got John Brandenburg with us, who thinks that my protocol for inveigling Abby Loeb into this this briar patch is well thought out.
He's my hero.
Well, we'll see if he actually rises to the bait, because there is...
Oh, he already has.
Yeah, but all he has to do is look at the damn moon rocks. Because there's not just chemistry and isotopes, there's machines. So you don't think he's going to take up the challenge?
No, he may very well do it. He may very well agree with you. I think your suggestion is eminently reasonable.
Thank you. Okay, Robert Morningstar, who was our civilian intelligence analyst, which
seems to be kind of a contradiction in terms. Thank you,
Richard. Robert, your thoughts? Given that you're really responsible for tonight. You know that, right?
Yes, I know. I could have named the novel after you, Robert. I didn't, but I could have.
I was so surprised when you wrote to me and told me the name. And Victor Norgaard is the name.
Yeah.
And a wonderful, you know what? That book, I asked experts about it, and Dr. Bruce Maccabee said that it was the most accurate book about UFO and the background of UFOs that anybody had ever written. And that's Dr.
Oh, my
Bruce
God.
Maccabee. Yeah.
Said that. Well, he actually sent me a private message saying that he really liked the novel and that it was really useful.
Yeah, he was more glowing in his response to me. And he said that you had access to real files, but that you had to write it as a
science fiction. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of science fiction, I'm so happy that you mentioned one of my favorite movies, The Mysterians.
The Mysterians. There you go, Robert.
Andrew and I get together. We have a midnight movie club. And about 2 years ago, I said, you've got to see The Mysterians. That revealed so much. Alien abductions, the taking of women, burying robots.
Japanese women into these black
buses. Exactly. Burying robots, earthquake-producing technologies. It's a classic. Tojo
Productions.
I recommend it to anyone.
And bases on the moon.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Bases on the far side of the moon. So
what I didn't have in there was animal mutilations.
Right. Right. Well, you covered that with The Thing and James Arness.
James Arness. I know.
So okay, Robert, we don't have a lot of time. It's amazing how 3 hours goes. What are your thoughts of the thin sections and the machines?
The thin sections show nanotechnology. And remember, I looked at that black and white, and when I said to you, what the hell is that? And I said, it looks like the inside of Andrew's desk, because I imagine protractors and straight edges and slide rules and all kinds of...
You know, what's so weird is when I looked at it again, because, again, my one of my cliches, you know, what you can't imagine, you can't see. I never imagined that this stuff would survive pounding and pounding and pounding. And then I did a little calculation, and I realized that most of the redistribution of the regolith, which is the lunar soil filled with the rocks and the junk, is far enough away so that the shock waves penetrate, but the temperatures, the high temperatures that vaporize things, are really restricted. So basically what meteors do when they impact the moon is they redistribute the rubble over and over, and they smash it smaller and smaller. So if I had my head on, I would have thought decades ago, oh, my God, we need to look at the rocks.
They compacted that. I have a surprise for you. The reason I recognize that stuff is that I held breccia and northracite, different samples of moon rocks, and I studied them under the microscope. And it's just a coincidence. Last night, Ron asked me why all the samples that the U.S. government gave to other countries turned out to be fake. And I said, because I believe there are fossils embedded in some of them.
Yes!
And
the Russians, remember the Lunokhod, Remember the Russians with the Lunokhod series, the unmanned rovers that they got to the moon, bathtub size, you know, with lids and solar panels. They had drilling equipment. They were able to collect and send back to Earth unmanned samples. And
really,
there are
quite a remarkable achievement.
There are all automatic back in the day of tubes, practically. And and they were able to analyze them, and they published papers showing fossils and biology in their samples, and none of our guys ever even responded.
That's why I said to Ron, there are fossils embedded in the samples. Now, during this conversation, as I wanted to show you some of the samples of the breccia that I had studied, I came across a breccia that has microchips embedded in it. It's the last picture that I sent you, and you can see the grid pattern in the broken microchips. It's the one that's a kind of green sample with blue chips in it, and they are rather large, and you can see exquisite grid patterns, parallels.
You mean like printed circuits?
Yeah, printed circuits, exactly so.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Well,
it's
form follows function. If
John, I'm going to send you an even better picture of it tomorrow so that you can start.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Okay, what we're going to do for everybody who's not seeing samples from Robert or from anybody else, because Ron's not connected, his data, neither is Andrew, we're rerunning this show tonight, tomorrow night, because it's so damn important. And the only way you get through the noise curtain these days is to be a signal, a redundant signal. So we're replaying this show tomorrow night for everybody out there. If they want to save, you know, pennies and not subscribe to Club 19.5, tell your friends, your family, the people who have been skeptical of what you've been interested in, tell them to listen free tomorrow night to The Other Side of Midnight. We'll go through this whole thing for them, and it's something they need to know, because I believe, John, your nuke was a warning. Someone wants us to stay in prison, and they're not happy with where we're going, the direction of disclosure, the direction of making these weird, you know, things that go bump in the night, part of mainstream culture, both at the DOD and at NASA with formal offices. And frankly, I think they followed up what was very subtle in 2014 with what they did to Maui, because Maui was an attack by enemies, not from Earth. I would bet dollars to Navy beans, because the technology is nothing that is loose on planet Earth.
Certainly a horrendous disaster. And
I think
there's
no explanation
for it.
I'd like to say something about Oumuamua.
Okay, and then I'll say something.
I read about Oumuamua 27 years ago when I picked up a book by Gurdjieff. It's called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson.
Mm.
In that novel, he describes Oumuamua to a T. It's called The Spaceship Karnak. And he gives a very unusual account of the evolution of human beings extraterrestrial engineering. He says, I'll read you the short sentence which describes it. It says that there were two satellites which broke off a planet during its early phase after it was hit by a comet, and they took orbits around the Earth. One was the Moon, and the second body, unknown to mankind, is called Anulios. But listen to this. In order to maintain cosmic stability, it was necessary that both bodies remain in Earth's orbit. To ensure this stability, men were required to emit a certain substance. An artificial organ was implanted into all human beings by the high powers, making them oblivious of this mechanism, but causing psychological side effects such as vanity, pride, and other vices. They caused to grow in the three brain beings there in a special way at the base of their spinal column, at the root of their tail, which they also at that time still had, and which part of their common presences furthermore still had its normal exterior, expressing the, so to this day, fullness of the inner significance. Gurdjieff was one of the most brilliant men of the 20th century.
When was this written, Bob?
this was written, he dictated it between 1927 and 1929. And many years ago, I read an account of Hitler saying that he had met the Superman, that
yes,
he had seen his presence and trembled at his presence. And I said, my God, what is this guy? And about 5 years ago, I found out that he was talking about Gurdjieff. That's rather significant. And Gurdjieff had this high cosmic knowledge.
Well, remember, Hitler and company were looking to Tibet as the last vestige of the ancient pre-catastrophe civilization that they could mine and use to own the world.
Yeah, the Atlantean root race. I wanted to ask John, what tipped off Abby Loeb to go and look in that region of the Pacific Ocean for what he found?
The Defense Department released, you know, images of the thing burning up, and they had basically, they just looked for where the track ended.
Was this within the last 3 years?
It was 2014 when the accident came in.
2014.
But they did not make it. But they didn't make it public until after Loeb had made a big deal about Oumuamua.
Because I was wondering if it possibly had some connection to the Tonga explosion, which you explored on the program.
No. Much too early. Much too early. Yeah.
So anyway...
But Tonga, I think, was another warning.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think so, too.
Well, the geometry, the energies, everything about it.
That was the big undersea volcano that erupted like a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, that one.
That was pretty interesting, watching that shockwave move. That was...
Well, look at the geometry. You know, I didn't post it tonight because we've done it on many
it
other shows.
Like a few.
Yeah. All right, we got a whole bunch of other people. I want to get a I want to get a non-technical person reaction here. Laura, that's you. Laura's background is in the social sciences. She has a brilliant podcast called Speaking of Jung. I did an interview with her some years ago. Apparently, it's one of the most downloaded, which I find interesting. And it turns out that Jung, before he decided to become the world's premier psychiatrist, was interested deeply in ancient archaeology. Laura?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here listening. I don't have anything intelligent to add to this conversation. I'm blown away. This is all far and above and beyond me, and I'm just trying to make sense of everything, but I appreciate hearing all of it. And
Wait. When you say it's above and beyond you, I don't believe that for a nanosecond.
Okay.
So what are some of the things that we've talked about that you may not quite understand?
Well, I was looking at Radio with Pictures, looking for some of the images, and I'm not seeing everything. Am I?
Yes, you are. Yeah.
That, I am. Okay.
That number 10 is a dangling participle.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm also interested in what's going on with Bennu crashing back to Earth, pieces of Bennu tomorrow. So that coverage starts at 10 o'clock. Yeah, you're definitely onto something. I did post on Twitter or X. Avi Loeb does not have a personal Twitter account, but the Galileo Project does. So I told him you guys were talking about him tonight, issuing him a challenge. So that's out there.
Well, I have tried for, 6 years, 7 years? I started this, back in 2014 with the Pluto flyby? I've been at this a long time. He has never responded to me. We had one brief conversation. He said it was too late at night, 10 o'clock here. He's back east. He's Boston, Cambridge. I thought to myself, well, if you're trying to change the world and introduce ET artifacts, the least you could do would be to take a nap. And, of course, he's been on George. He's been on Clyde. He's been everywhere. He will not come on this show. So I have a feeling it has to do with Oumuamua, but I can't be certain. But I do have contacts, one hops, as we used to call them, people I can talk to and they can talk directly to him. By hook or by crook, and with the help of this audience, we're going to get Loeb to take the appropriate position and test the hypothesis, given that so far, every single member of the panel who's been on says they see the artifacts, they see the micro machines, they see the geometry. And I didn't handpick you. I just, we've got people who frankly don't see it. And we have one of those with us tonight, I think. Do you want to come on and sign in?
You got to give my name.
Oh, well, I didn't want to put you in a rough spot. Barbara does not, at least as of yesterday, did not see what we're talking about. Has anything changed? Barbara Honegger.
Well, first off, don't put words in my mouth, please. But I am impressed with number 7. And I believe that's the first photograph that you sent to John Brandenburg.
Mm-hmm.
That is very interesting. My first thought was, why couldn't all of these thousands of thin slices of these are moon rocks, correct?
These are moon rock brushes.
Yeah. Why couldn't artificial intelligence be applied to, even though they're thin slices, for looking for patterns across these
things?
Well,
of course they can. And that's why what Nelson said at the pre-press conference, 1 hour on Thursday, about the study and the setting up of the UAP office and all that, he said AI and ML, and I had to look up ML, it's machine learning. In other words, they're dependent overwhelmingly on looking at what we already know is out there with AI, because AI is the new God. Notice that Barbara does not trust humans, but she will trust a computer to tell her that something is artificial. That's how far we have come.
No, that's not fair to me, Richard, I don't trust
her. I'm being a little facetious, dear. Come on, we know each other
long
enough.
You're being very facetious.
Okay.
but anyway, I am impressed with number 7. There's something extremely unusual about that it looks like a multifaceted jewel. It definitely does not look natural.
With wires, which are three-dimensional, they're cylindrical. And one of them.
Well, I don't know about wires, but.
Well, look. See, you need to understand what light does when it hits geometry. And that's where most of our educations were woefully deficient. You know, some of us have been doing a lot of, you know, post-whatever work. But most people look at these things and they have no basis for even understanding what they're looking at, let alone its three-dimensional nature.
Well, that's my point. It seems to me that maybe AI, and I don't think we have to wait for somebody else, it seems to me that there should be some kind of AI program that you yourself could probably get online and apply to, for instance, number 7, to try to pull out of this thin slice what are the possible three-dimensional geometric formations.
Okay.
Geometric forms.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because let me give you a little more background of how I intend to approach the analysis. Every time you do a thin section of a rock, a thin slice, the rock is deficient by one slice of itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you do enough slices, you literally section the entire rock into a huge collection of thin sections, right?
Right.
Which are like cross sections of a three-dimensional something buried in the rock, in the matrix.
That's exactly my point. I think we should be able to reconstruct
the
three-dimensional object.
Now, is NASA willing to sacrifice a rock or two and thin section the entire thing to build up a three-dimensional image? It doesn't have to, because you can do the same thing now with X-rays, with X-ray fluorescence, with beam analyzers. In other words, you are basically thin sectioning is the inverse of what we call 3D printing, which is made up in a machine of a matrix, putting coatings down, letting them set, putting another coating down, et cetera, right? So this is just the reverse, and whatever a computer can create in a 3D, machine, then the same kind of AI intelligence could deconstruct from taking thin sections that don't even involve physically attacking the rock. You could do this with high energy X-ray beams or gamma rays maybe. In other words, you would get an idea and you'd be able to rotate it in 3D on a screen what the hidden matrix of the rock is concealing in the way of inclusions, full three-dimensional inclusions, which might in fact be a much bigger machine that would be the size of the rock, which is like a foot or
right.
so.
Right. No, I understand.
Computer tomography.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a comment and a question, and then you can turn it over to somebody else. My comment is I just wanted to remind you, you were close to opening the show tonight by mentioning this very strange experience with the guy with the duster at NASA. And I don't think you said who this guy was.
I don't remember his name. It's been so many.
What category was he?
He was supposed to be a news person that was being squired around to other news people, because that was what we call our press credentials. You signed in like, you know, the Stansville shopper. Back in those days, NASA was so eager to have what it was doing covered. It accredited everybody who had a pretense of a news credential.
What category was he? Was he mainstream media?
No. He was this Western-looking dude with a he had like a literal canvas bag, and he would pull out these press releases and hand them to everybody that introduced him to personally. So
Bristow must have known what was in the press release.
Of course he did. Yeah. It was part of NASA's planting the meme. So when we get to tonight, people will say, oh, we never went to the moon. I mean, Kinthea had a show with a couple of weeks ago with Bart Seibel, who claims to this day that we never went to the moon.
Well, the Russians brought back samples, and we compared their samples and our samples. We said, we'll show you ours if you show you yours. And the Russians knew we went to the moon because they monitored all our transmissions.
Yes.
Right. I
want to make a footnote here that last night we had a show with Morningstar and Robert Gibran, and also some information from a friend for the counter.
Oh, ho, ho. I'm not the Robert. I'm the Ron. Yeah.
I said Ron and Robert as a counter.
There you go.
The previous show. So we were doing bookends, both sides of the topic. Back to you, Barbara.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to make one other comment, and that is also close to the beginning of tonight's show. You mentioned, of course, Apollo 11, which was in conjunction with this guy with a duster passing out these strange press releases.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to remind everybody, on previous shows, I've done at least two of the Other Side of Midnight shows on the interview that I did with the Navy officer who was the Navy's weatherman at Pearl Harbor at the time of Apollo 11. And as you know, he literally saved the Apollo 11 astronauts, Neil Armstrong and the other two, from certain death upon splashdown by checking the weather over the pre-programmed splashdown site. And he determined, using the Corona satellite that, you know, the Corona satellite was turned towards the moon, right? They used the Corona satellite photography to determine that over the pre-programmed splashdown location, there was what was called a vertical 250-mile-an-hour vertical whirlwind called a Screaming Eagle Formation that would have completely torn apart their parachutes, and they would have died upon splashdown. And so he was able to change, to get the location changed, because synchronistically, he still was cleared for the Corona satellite program. And he got the splashdown location changed a little bit further to the east. This information finally was able to be published 30 years afterwards. It had been classified for 30 years. And he came into my office at the Naval Postgraduate School shouting out, I need a journalist. And he was ushered into my office. I was a senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School here in Monterey. And I got the story. And I'm going to to send to Keith the article that was published in a DOD publication that I wrote based upon that. And his name was Navy Captain Sam Houston, directly this direct descendant of the Sam Houston of Texas.
Well, good.
Wow.
Good.
Yeah. Richard, Barbara, Robert, anybody that'll listen, there's a detail about Avi Loeb's evidence that I haven't heard anybody consider.
Well, anybody John's heard? The perfect person. Go for it.
Yeah, okay. One of the things we can do in a lab, metal samples, is determine if it's something like uranium. They actually have that catalog. They know where every place on Earth is, every single mine that
sure.
produces it. And so they could run those tests on if there's uranium in there and see if it was terrestrially originated.
And very good, very good. They can do the same thing with the lithium too.
Yeah, there you
go. I think that's very important, because my very first take on that was that this could be a cover story, that this is perhaps an Israeli nuclear powered object,
and
that it's a really good cover story.
I'd like to say something about item number 7 from Richard.
Okay.
My first impression immediately when I saw that large object in the upper left-hand corner, which you say had the wire,
mm-hmm.
I said to myself, that looks like a piece of crystal memory. And so...
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
A microchip in the recent breccia, the last piece I sent you, and I think that is... crystal memory, and so you may be finding pieces of a gigantic computer or a microcomputer that was obliterated and compacted in that breccia sample. That's all.
Mm. That's a very interesting idea.
Okay, we've literally got about a minute till the break. Does anybody have something they want to leave as a cliffhanger for the next segment?
Sure. You keep talking about wires, and you know I'm on board with this. I said, hey, that looks like a replicator chip, but you do find crystals with intrusions that look like fibers and or wires. I've got some sitting not too far from me on my shelf here right now, so that they might not be wires. The rest of it, I'm fine with.
Sure.
Well, if they're not, remember, an ion beam microprobe literally thermalizes a sample like this on a microscope stand or in a vacuum and reads off at the atomic level the composition of everything that you point the beam at and makes a recording, spectrographic. And then you can do chromatography. You can do all kinds of physical analysis. So if we're looking at crystals, it will show up in the analysis. If we're looking at machines, that will show up. And Loeb is perfectly positioned because every sample, every 842 pounds NASA brought back is by definition not, you know, under some kind of national security, whatever. It's public domain, and it needs to be publicly analyzed. Okay, we are at the...
One way you could pitch this to him, by the way, is say, look for evidence of extraterrestrial... an extra solar materials on the moon, because they can tell by the isotopes.
Yeah,
they can tell that
of course.
The iron isotopes in the sample they got were not from this solar system.
Well, that's been part of the discussion we're going to have when we come back from the break. My guest this morning, John Brandenburg, and the entire Enterprise Mission team has practically showed up here, which is very good. We will continue this discussion. I will give out phone numbers if you want to join us by phone or through Blog Talk, and you want to ask a pissy question to myself or any of the panelists. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment to your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And we're having a small circuit problem there. Let me do this. There we are. Live radio, folks, backstage.
Okay, Richard, I'm going to have to, I can give you about another 15 minutes, and then I'm going to have to, I'm fading.
Okay. Well, you've done more than yeoman service because you brought a pedigreed PhD to the conversation who looks at what I've been presenting and says, they're artifacts.
A very reasonable interpretation to me, given the scenarios that one can easily imagine have occurred on the moon.
Ruggiero just sent me a note. Is Ruggiero on the line? Is he on with the rest of the panel?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, speak up a little louder.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I'm
Yes, yes.
Hello, everyone. Hello, John.
Okay. You are saying you cannot see the wire, right?
I cannot see the wire, Richard,
okay,
unless it's at the bottom.
Let me show you exactly where it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're looking at number 7, right?
Yeah.
You've clicked on number 7, and it's big now on your screen.
Yeah, it's big.
You see the bottom left-hand part of the artifact, the highly geometric kind of tannish green.
Yeah.
Okay. Look at the little white oval just to mm-hmm. the bottom left of it with something draped across it.
Yeah, the bit that's bisected it through the middle.
Yep. Okay. That little thing bisecting that little oval, that is one of the wires. It's three-dimensional. You can see the shadow. It's a cylinder. And then at the very bottom, it's trailed off as a little thread that disappears at the edge of the white oval.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the white ovals are caused by the saw slicing through this thin section. And diamond saws create heat. So in the process of sawing this little thin section off the moon rock, the heat melted the wire and caused that little driblet right to the edge of the white oval. That's the melted wire.
I see it.
And it goes up, and then it branches, and it crosses, and there's another cylinder going down and one at right angles. And, yeah, this is a three-dimensional. I think Robert may have nailed it. It looks like some kind of microchip.
Yeah, when we spoke like last week when I first saw these images, I said to you it looks like a lead stained glass window.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it does.
And the way you put together a stained glass window is the craftsmen use lead because it's low melting point, and if they have to replace a pane, it's not a pane to replace the pane. See what I mean?
And I lost my friend.
But look at the rest of the image. The more you look, the more you're going to see.
It's incredible. I didn't even know that was sliced across. I thought that was just the face of the.
No. This is if we did enough thin slices, as Barbara said, we could reconstruct the whole thing because we're just looking. Think of it as it's the inverse of the 3D printing, but it's also what you do in MRI machines with, I think, onset of
MRI scans.
A three-dimensional tomography is a technical name. All of these tools on Earth, we got 1,000 pounds. All we need is some guy to run point. And until Loeb says, I'm not the guy, I'm going to let him run with this because he's got everything in place. He's got the technicians. He's got the technology. He's got the microscopes, the electron microscopes. He's got everything. All he needs is a armed guard to bring him some samples from Houston to whatever lab he's using. And they stand there as he runs the experiments and then takes them back to Houston. And I guarantee you the world changes if that's done.
Is that writing inside that opening on that parallel lines that are in the inside that opening?
Are you talking number 7?
Yeah.
They might be.
Writing.
Yeah, it might be. It might. Wouldn't that be astonishing?
Richard, I want to bring up a piece. I want to go to...
No, Keith has a really good point here because I hadn't really looked carefully, but that does look at...
Oh, okay.
It almost could be writing. Go ahead. Go ahead, Ruggiero.
Did you get the email? You did get the email because you replied. When I sent you over that fascinating Spanish podcast YouTube video, I gave you the screenshot.
Go ahead.
You mean
from the Chandrayaan control room?
Well, firstly, we'll backtrack a bit. The screenshot I sent you of NASA's wonderful podcast in Spanish shows a bizarre, it's not named a planet, there's mysteries of the solar system, let's call it that. But it's got this very bizarre moonscape with a few plants on it.
Oh, yeah.
Satellite dish.
Yeah, I remember the graphic. It was, the colors are like what we see on the moon. By the
way,
did anybody happen to notice our banner for tonight? If you go to the top of the guest page or you go to the main page, it's sitting there. This is an Apollo 17 image of something called Tracy's Rock. Because Gene Cernan, when he was investigating it, that's him on the left, the astronaut next to the rock, and the rover's on the right. First of all, notice the color.
Yeah.
Don't you find the color bizarre?
I do find the.
Isn't the moon supposed to be gray?
Is that a real picture?
This is, of course, it's a real picture.
No, I mean, you know,
all I've done is increase the saturation to bring out what they've been hiding for 50 years. The moon is a stunningly brilliant, you know, prism dappled place with all kinds of extraordinary artistic, hint, hint, Cynthia, colors.
Yeah.
Colors
so
that have no business being there.
Unless, Richard,
go ahead.
Yeah,
wait a minute. You're breaking up.
I'm modified. So if I go to number 5,
okay,
and we go back to the colors on that picture, which I know Keith's going to add later, because no one would have seen the image unless they've been on the NASA website. So, to your point, number 5 brings in all those stunning colors that we've been seeing on the Chandrayaan mission, and that image that you just posted on the title screen, they're all in there on number 5. And we're seeing those reflections back on Chandrayaan, which they showed on that first video, which was on the Economic Times from the previous shows, which shouldn't have been there, and on the Chandrayaan flyby of the moon when they're coming down ready to land, just seeing all these lovely, you know, reflective prismatic colors coming through, and there they are on your little sample. And number 8, I don't even know what to make a manga movie. And I think I'll open the floor back to the team. I think these rocks are outstanding and interesting. And I'd love to hear everybody's further comments.
Okay. So who else have we called up yet?
Well, I will jump
in. Oh, there you are.
There you are.
The colors are amazing, of course. Any artist would love to paint these. And I guess each color is reflecting a different kind of material that it's made of.
Well, and not exactly, because when you do thin sections, which have to be literally, you know, hundredths of a millimeter in thickness, otherwise the rock is opaque, if you use polarized light, the light will refract through certain crystals with certain colors and other crystals with different colors. So it's not really a pigment. It's more the fundamental interaction of light and the mineral thickness and the way light waves bounce around and interfere with each other. It's more like the colors you see on a soap bubble than it is in terms of pigment.
But why are the colors between 8 and the others so different?
Because it's different samples, different materials, different rocks.
So it's not the lighting that's being applied to it.
No. To do thin sectioning and to get petrology analysis, you basically keep everything else constant, thickness of your sample, light sources, polarization, all that, because the difference will show you different minerals reflecting or interacting with light different ways. Yeah, number 8 is a totally different rock. Again, only from Apollo 16, it's like I've got this huge candy store and I've had no time to go through the shelves. You know how that feels.
Oh, I do.
So yeah, take a look. You know,
about number 7.
Say again?
I said I have one more observation about number 7.
Okay.
So we're looking at the what I call the crystal memory. If you go directly to the right, one below you'll see a brown circle, but if you go directly to the right, as I look into that, it looks to me like a section through a rusty bolt.
Exactly. It's a nut and bolt. Bingo,
and bolt,
Robert.
Right.
Bingo.
Right.
Yeah.
Very fascinating stuff.
Again, none of this should be here. All those white things, those are three-dimensional objects sliced by the diamond saw. So you're looking at the tops of them, and you can actually see, because the angle is not exactly 90 degrees, they have three-dimensional character, like the one on the far right. That looks like a big wire. Look at the upper left-hand portion about the 10 o'clock position. And it's like a cross-section, and it's overexposed, because, of course, the light value in this crystal is, or this sample is way higher than you can represent on one screen. But if you look carefully at all of these, and again, I picked them totally at random. It's like the first three I found, and it was like, what are the odds that I'm going to pick three random cross-sections of lunar rocks and find damn artifacts in all three?
Yes.
That tells me.
I'd also like to point out where you see the ones that look like perfect circles.
Yeah.
Those, I believe, are where you've sliced through a wire.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why they're perfect circles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once again, in the crystal memory, as I'll call it, if you look into each of the panes, it looks like there are three-dimensional printed circuits and objects within each pane, especially the top one, which almost seems to have a pentagram in it. Parallel lines cutting across the apex of a scalene triangle.
Are we talking number 6?
No, number still number 7. Fascinating, number 7.
Okay.
In the uppermost pane, it looks like a scalene triangle with parallel lines cutting through it, almost making a star.
Yep.
And the lower left section looks like it has another crystal embedded within the crystal. Fascinating. It's fantastic thinking.
So if this
modulation,
say again,
it kind of looks like audio modulation, a waveform of audio modulation. Can't make it out, but it looks like it is an audio modulation.
So
it's a print of some sort.
Well, hang on a second. Hang on. If the materials are created the way I think they are, which is shock from meteor impact, the shock waves are going to thaw, melt, and then refreeze, and you may actually get a frozen section of a shock wave in the matrix. Don't everybody speak at once?
I just say it's possible.
Exactly. The thing I'm saying is, either Loeb or someone else, or we, this team, is going to pursue this to the ends of the planet. We're going to get public confirmation of what's in public owned lunar samples with zero national security nonsense around them. Zero. And if we don't, remember, we've got some very interesting allies now in Congress there's a certain congressman from Tennessee named Tim Burchett, who I think might be interested in seeing this, given that he seems so intrigued with Grush's comments about spaceships and bodies the Congress had never been allowed to see.
I wonder what David Sereda
is. I don't think Loeb.
Okay, this is David Sereda.
You hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I've studied microelectronics in great detail, and one of the things you see versus studying, like, everything under the microscope, right down to the crystal lattice on the periodic table, but we're not that small here at all.
Nope.
Has geometry, and every element on the periodic table falls into different hexagonal, pyramidal, cubic, you know, body-centered cubic, face-centered
yes.
cubic, rhombohedral. So this doesn't look like anything like that.
No, it doesn't.
When you study, like, the birth of the transistor and the crystal oscillator, the way they make oscillators and transistors, John Bardeen, Will Shockley, Will Bratton, finalized after going through many different types of transistors, the transistor that led to today's transistors. And the way they do it is you use multiple layers of different types of crystal and conductor, and your conductor will be either paramagnetic, diamagnetic, ferromagnetic materials, because you would have these PNP and NPN, negative, positive, negative, and positive, negative, positive transistors in the early days. Today's transistors are down to 2/1,000,000ths of a meter. That's how small they are.
That's 2 nanometers.
That's 2 nanometers. So what they look like when the first transistors came out are similar to item 7 in that you would put wafers of your conductor, and then your crystal would be fused in between those wafers to trap vibrations in what are called oscillators. Crystal oscillators are your frequency generators in your microelectronics. Your transistors used to be amplifiers, and then they got into gates, which are basically storing everything from, you know, colors and data. And the same way, like a magnetic hard drive works, again, you'll have these little chambers. What interests me about this structure is from years and years and years of studying microelectronics and materials, it has all these interesting angles. And I got my protractor out. Mm-hmm. I'm zoomed way in. And I'm zoomed way in. And when you zoom way in Photoshop, there are so many angles within angles within angles.
Exactly.
If you go further in, like, go in on all those what look like chopsticks, and they have angles within them too. Like, and it's, oh my God, this is an interesting looking thing. And those angles you don't normally see in our microelectronics, but maybe I can understand the power and the significance of discovering the angle between two charge plates in a crystal oscillator may be very profound and something we need to research. Because I'm measuring angles with my protractor here, and there are some pretty interesting numbers here in all these different angles. And
okay.
Again,
my favorite.
This could.
Go yeah. ahead, David. Go ahead.
Well, I would say from studying the history, if you study the history of the crystal oscillator and the transistor and resistors, which are, you know, have you seen those tiny, tiny little coils that were discovered in, I forget what part, in the Middle East, they found samples of what could be extraterrestrial micro material. Micro means millionth of a meter material. And you see these tiny, 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 clearly they are coils. And coils act as resistors, and resistors build up magnetic fields.
Yeah, but wait, David, you just said extraterrestrial. See, if our history is a lot more interesting than we've been allowed to know, and there have been previous high-tech epochs on Earth, then we could be looking on Earth not at ET samples, but our own samples, human race, previous cultures a million years old, that everything else is gone except for the elements, and if it's properly matrixed, maybe some geometry is preserved. maybe. But it's much less prevalent than on the moon, because on Earth, as Robert said, or Ron said, or somebody said, it keeps getting destroyed and destroyed and destroyed and melted and remelted and moved around and plate tectonics and erosion. The moon is passive, a huge museum by comparison.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd like to say something about number seven again.
Okay.
From what Keith observed and what David said, and I've been thinking about this during the show, it occurs to me that there could be sounds embedded in each of those panes. And with the proper technology and equipment, we could hear sounds from each of those panes the way Captain J.J. Adams heard the Krell music in Forbidden Planet.
Look, we may find an actual... We have no idea what 1,000 pounds of rocks from the moon, most of which have not been looked at, have not
that
been...
One pane,
well, we need to...
Rich,
electron
pane,
microscope.
Wait, is it a case? Case? Yeah, go ahead.
The one pane that's got the trapezoid type shape to it, the
right.
longest one,
right.
with the brown, that is audio modulation. It's, we're looking at half of the waveform. If we could take that, we could probably decode it and we'd get some kind of audio out of it.
Oh, my.
Because that's
God.
What it is. That's all.
That's
audio.
Exactly what I meant.
Well, you can induce frequencies on them, and through feedback, they will resonate, and you can record that.
Oh, the
you could copy that and rectify it so it's on a plane and play it through one of your sound generators.
Up until tonight, our conversation, including ours, has been totally about remote sensing photographs, which show ancient civilization artifacts all over the damn solar system. But the turning point tonight is we now know where to find almost 1,000 pounds of physical samples, most of which have not been touched. That was NASA's philosophy from the beginning, put most of it away for when technology advances over 10, 20, 30, you know, half a century. Well, that's where we are tonight. We have incredible new technology which could tell us an infinite story about every one of those rocks and all the stuff in prison. All we got to do is open the damn doors and get someone to do the analysis.
Well, Richard, as you have more than
1,000
pounds.
Wait, I'm getting overlapping. Go ahead.
I was going to say it has to be more than 1,000 pounds because Edgar Mitchell brought 800 pounds himself on Apollo 14.
No. None of the missions.
Yes.
Wrong. The total poundage that we have from every mission is 842 pounds and change. But that's overwhelming.
The thing I got from Ed Mitchell is he brought back 800 pounds, and most of it was limestone, and it showed that there was a lot of water on the moon.
Send me a link. Because I... Remember, I have kind of been immersed in this since Apollo.
Yes, I know. So have I. And I knew Edgar Mitchell. And
then he obviously misspoke.
I published a monograph from the University of Tennessee.
I would say that Mitchell misspoke because it's a total is under 1,000 pounds from six missions.
See, Richard, if that geometric structure on number seven is conductor and semiconductor material,
mm-hmm.
the probability that it's microelectronics or even like the first transistors were big. You could see everything with your eye.
Oh, yeah.
And then they got smaller and smaller. And this isn't – we don't know what's the size scale of this photograph. What I'm saying is if there's conductor and semiconductor layers in there, the chance that it's an electronic component is very high because nature doesn't do that very often. I mean, yes, it does. Like granite, for example, would have mica, which is a dielectric, and it'll have quartz, and it'll have even uranium in it. But, I mean, the way it's structured, I mean, I've looked at crystals all my life, including under the microscope, and studied them. And if you talk to John Hutchison about this, who also has a wealth of experience, I mean, for example, a capacitor, right? A capacitor stores electric charges between wafers of conductor and semiconductive layers, and the Casimir effect, right? You're looking at at but what's interesting about this guy is it's got all these angles in, and there.
What has the Casimir effect got to do with it?
Well, because when you build something,
I have to step in occasionally.
Right.
Go ahead.
If you build something with wafers that are really close together, they can trap an electric charge between them, and the semiconductor material between those darker lines, which could be a conductor material, would create a Casimir effect. But if the plates touch, then the charge
dissipates.
Basically dissipates, it shorts out.
Yeah.
But there may
yes.
be something about angle in micro, if you look at our microelectronics, you don't see angles like this, but maybe there's something we're missing.
Well, take a look
angles.
At number eight. My favorite of the three I put up tonight is number eight because it's,
oh, I know.
It's
I
shadowed.
It. It's incredible.
It's shadowed. It's three-dimensional object. It's not crystals. It's machines. It's fractured, broken machines. There's cylinders. There are cones. There are right angles. There are plates. There's three-dimensional right angle geometry like the one on the bottom left corner just above the Enterprise mission logo. I mean, again, this is totally at random. I didn't pre-select. I just took bing, bing, bing and looked at them and went, holy cow.
Richard, it looks like
yeah, there's your size scale.
The computer screen.
1 millimeter is your size scale on – it shows you in the red line at the top. So, you know, a millimeter you can see. So this – remember, when they made the first transistors and crystal oscillators, you could see them at the millimeter size scale. And then as the frequencies got higher, and like, you know how many transistors there are in an Intel chip? There's like 3 billion transistors.
Number eight is filled with three-dimensional junk, fractured, smashed junk.
I know, but if you zoom in on that with an electron microscope, we might see – well, you should see – what oscillators look like today in an iPhone. You have to get down to the billionth of a meter scale camera, electron microscope, to see the machine. I mean, the machine level, the mechanistic level today is so tiny you need electron microscopes to see it. We're looking at 1 millimeter here. So each one of these very interesting looking pieces, if we could find out what each one of those different colors and the gray and the silver are made of.
That's what ion microbeams will let you do.
And if
number
you
eight
see,
looks like a drawing
you,
to me.
Richard, can I stick something in here? I looked through them, but I don't see it. Do you have an unaltered version of the picture that's got the replicator chip on it so that people can see what it looked like to the naked eye?
Yeah, I could put it up, but it's just darker.
Well, I think that's important for evidentiary things because has anyone looked at the samples the Japanese brought back from their asteroid? I was surprised not to see one of those there. I would have put one up if not. There's at least one, remember they collected it out in the Australian outback and they showed everybody a tray of it before they even put it away. And I saw something that looked like that little replicator chip. Sorry, that's just what it looks like.
Ron, we're at the bottom of the hour. Hang on, everyone.
Of course.
We'll bring Ron back and everyone else. This is pretty important because I believe I'm getting a consensus that there's something really exquisitely unusual here. And I hear people making qualifiers like interesting. If I hear interesting one more time, it's more than interesting. We've got them. All we need now, when the shouting dies away, is a political process to get the truth before the American people and everybody else. And so for the last half hour, I want to talk about strategies. How do we take this to the next level? And no idea will be ruled too far out to be discussed in the next half hour. You're on the other side of midnight on an historic show where our panelists agree overwhelmingly we're looking at ET artifacts that are interesting. We shall return.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. Last half hour to go. God, this has been an incredibly fast show. I look at the clock and I'm thinking, wait a minute, there's something wrong. We need more time. So we'll have more time. Obviously, we're going to do more of this when we get more data. And I'm going to try a really interesting effort to get directly to Abby Loeb. I got close the other day with one of his secretaries. So we'll do that again and we'll open up that hailing frequency and we'll try several others. One of the things I do want to do, is there anybody that has not had airtime that would like to say something? And before we get into the important part, which is how do we take this to the next level? Because if this just sits here with us, it'll go nowhere. It's got to be democratized at a politically relevant level where it goes much further. And my best bet is Congressman Tim Burchette from Tennessee. But if anybody has better ideas, lay them on the table. And I'll also give out our numbers. Let me give everybody a number. If you want to join our merry band tonight, if you got something you want to say, a comment, a question, 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. One more time with feeling, 917-889-8802. And I think I heard Ron clearing his voice.
I don't know if I can clear my voice, but yeah, I'm out here. I'm not sure where it fits into your options there, but I'm bothered by one thing that relates to Dr. Loeb. His whole presentation is to convince everybody that he found something, which I'm certainly not saying he did not, that he found something that was from outside the solar system. They make a big deal out of that without even mentioning Oumuamua. And this stuff was, you know, picked up locally. You know, there's no question that this stuff was collected on the moon, on Ryugu, on Bennu that will hopefully come down in a few hours safely in this Great Salt Lake area. And I think that's important because I think part of the NASA pitch is that, well, there might be aliens somewhere else, but nothing's happened here. And so if they typecast this as, oh, well, this is just somebody saying that there were aliens here, then they can sort of sidestep even solid, unarguable evidence like this by saying, well, it's not from, you know, real extrasolar stuff. It's from mistaken local stuff.
Well, this is where our audience and the power of, you know, people, American citizens or global citizens, comes in. Because if everybody in this audience tonight, just everybody in our audience, were to send Abby Loeb through the Galileo website an email and saying, for God's sake, look at the damn stuff from the moon. There's machines in there and you can test. That will have an effect politically because Loeb wants to lead the charge. He wants to be the white knight riding on the horse with the big lance that leads humanity into an interstellar civilization receptivity. We are now giving him on a silver platter with gold handles and platinum edges an extraordinary entree into that conversation to be the hero that he wants to be. The only question is he going to pick up the phone?
Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah, is Laura still on?
Sure is.
Good. I'd just like to ask Laura, if you haven't already, Laura, be sure and, you know, I think you said there was a Facebook page or a Twitter account for the Galileo Project, right?
Yes, on Twitter.
Be sure and let Avi Loeb know that this program is being rebroadcast tomorrow night.
Right.
Yep.
I'll make a note of that. Yeah, I'll do it right now, actually.
And maybe send the direct link. Richard, will the link to tonight's show, will the audio be available at the same link tomorrow night, or will it be a different link?
That's a technical question for Keith. Keith, what's the answer?
Keith?
We can send Laura a link.
Yeah.
What was the question?
Yeah, I'll get it. And I'll actually do it tomorrow because it's, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, you want it to go in about 8 a.m.
Okay. I will do that.
Oh, that's her midday, 8 a.m.
Right, exactly.
Hey, Richard.
Exactly.
Richard, yes. I'm zoomed in really far now, and I can see a coil.
Super. Because John,
I'm zoomed in.
I think Brandenburg has left. Is John left? I'm not looking at the right screen.
Which image is that?
Yes, John had to leave.
Right. Okay. Three days ago, when I ran this stuff by John, not knowing what he would react, the first thing he said was, "Do you see any gears?" And I said, "John, why are you back in the 18th century? Interstellar extraterrestrials do not use gears. They use friction fields and manipulation of the torsion field and all that. But if you found a coil is a coil is a coil, and you can't build electronics without coils."
Yeah, I can.
Super.
I can. The way you do this is you take it in Photoshop, adjust your brightness. Even those bright cross sections, you can really drop the brightness down
to
the structure. But in the lines, in all these angular lines in number 7 in the geometry, I believe I'm looking at a coil there. Now, I've seen these tiny, tiny coils, like I said, in material that has been retrieved. And those coils I'll actually have to get pictures of for a follow-up because they're so small, the size scale of those coils that have been found in extraterrestrial crash retrieved material are clearly coils. They're not random, natural kind of coiling or spiraling. But probably the size scale that I'm looking at right now, the fact that those slices that are all like chopsticks that form all these angles, I'm looking at one of them right now. Some of them have violet purple cell structure, which is very odd for if it was pure conductor material. It's got there's more structure within the structures.
The so-called smart material that Art was analyzed years ago called Art's Parts. One of the things that stood out was it was made of micro layers. A layered composite technology that can only really be done in a vacuum and probably zero G, which indicated an extraterrestrial technology that at the time that Art got it, we didn't have on Earth. So
are conductors.
Well, I can well imagine that we're dealing with a technology which goes down and down and down, and each layer does something else, and there's cross linkages and communication and pulses and timing and resonance. In other words, we're looking at 1,000 pounds of stunning ET technology on Earth, and we know it's addressed.
Hey, I think Avi Loeb's the wrong guy. I think William Tiller, if he's still alive, because he's and Gary Nolan, who's at Stanford, you need a microelectronic expert
to take this on. And Avi Loeb is not that guy. I mean, he might act as a manager of the project and get microelectronic experts.
Well, given that politically he's what was that? Is that Ron?
No, I'm on your side, Richard. I think Avi Loeb is the perfect choice.
Well, we start with the political, and then we move in a multidisciplinary simultaneous front to contact other people that we know. David knows a hell of a lot of people. He's been around the high atmospheric, very thin stratosphere of this, you know, government technology and development for decades. So whoever you can reach out to, everyone take this as a mission. Take one person who you might think could open the door to getting public analysis and confirmation, because that's the key. We don't want anybody doing all this behind closed doors and saying, oh, we didn't find anything. No way. And legally, we've got the NASA charter on our side. This has to be done in public.
Well, also,
go ahead.
Fuji is about to come out with an affordable 100 megapixel SLR.
Oh, my God.
It's going to come out in the next few weeks. And if you photograph this same sample at 100 megapixels and you do what I'm doing now, you're going to get pretty incredible data.
I did not parse. I did not look for the best resolution. I didn't look for, you know, TIFF images as opposed to JPEG. I just quick grabbed three that looked to me eyeball. And the more I looked, the more I found. And they're totally unselected. They're random. And if you got three out of three, how much does that mean for the 842 pounds of samples? It means they're chock full of incredible breakthroughs. Incredible.
Yeah, there's layers within layers, and even the resolution you have here, this JPEG, and I can see, like I say, coil structures, cell structures.
I love number 8. My favorite tonight is number 8. Yeah. I know the others are more winsome for some, but number 8, look at all that three-dimensional geometry. That's not crystallography. That has nothing to do with the way minerals melt together in a volcano.
You're not that far yet. Yeah, you're not down that small. I can look at electron microscope of uranium, and when you see it's really interesting. When you look at natural crystals, it doesn't matter what it is on the periodic table, it doesn't look like this. Until you get right down to the crystal lattice scale, yeah, you'll see geometry at that scale. That's atoms building molecules. But at this scale, we're at 1 millimeter. To see this kind of geometry at 1 millimeter in natural crystals, yeah, of course you can see natural crystals. You can. But it doesn't look like this. This isn't what... just doesn't look like this. This almost looks like scrap metal.
Yes, it does, because it's fragments. Like, it's pounded.
Yeah.
Look, back during the Cold War, remember the Air Force wanted umpteen million nuclear weapons? And at some point, the other side said, wait a minute, how many times can you bombard the Soviet Union before you're simply making the rubble bounce? What we have here is an example of impacts over billions of years that have made the lunar rubble bounce. And every bounce makes it smaller and fragmented and tinier and tinier. I'm surprised we have things that are of this size, given the nature of the lunar surface. But I will add, I want everybody to go to my number 9. I found this the other day, serendipitously, not looking for it at all, looking for something else. It turns out this is a 1999 total eclipse photograph taken during the eclipse that crossed in August 11th, Europe. And it was taken by a German astronomer with the ESO observatory, taken somewhere in mid-Europe, probably in Germany, and it was taken through a Polaroid filter, two crossed Polaroid filters, which for some reason he figured out to do. And what you see there is the signature of cross Polaroids on the corona, but the moon is surrounded in this particular photo with a stunningly forward scattering light ring, which is the damn lunar dome. We're dealing with a technology in the dirt, in the regolith, in the breccias, in the rocks the astronauts brought back. We're dealing with a range of technologies from people who build little houses, you know, like Quonset huts, all the way up to the folks who redesigned the solar system and left domes around at least the moon and Ganymede for us to wander about in and wonder who did it. So we have a stunning opportunity here. I want to devote the last 15 minutes to how do we get this across the finish line? No ideas are too far out. Who wants to begin? Barbara, you're our political expert. How do we get people in the know to pay attention?
Well, first allow me to say that if I understood correctly, I agree with David Sarita. I don't think we should put all of our eggs into the Avi Loeb basket. My intuition does not trust him.
Well, we'll know pretty soon if he ignores this, because no scientist in their right mind can look at these photos and go, ah, nothing to see here, move along.
No, that's...
Wait a minute. Trust him in what sense? Yeah, okay, good.
Hold on. That's not what I mean. You hinted at it, Richard, if I understood you correctly, your hint earlier in the show tonight. And that was when you said you asked a question of someone else. To the effect that, well, don't you think the Department of Defense chose Avi Loeb to go look at this thing, to follow the track to where it crashed?
Yep.
I think that it is passingly strange that the U.S. Defense Department would choose Avi Loeb.
Well, how do you know they did?
Well, that's what.
Well, that was my hypothesis, because what are the, you know, it's kind of like my Casablanca reference earlier. You know, the other great one, you know, all the gin joints in all the world, she came into mind, that kind of thing. Of all the people,
round up the usual suspects.
Of all the people the DOD could have given that data to.
Yeah.
Loeb is the guy who wants to be Mr. E.T., extraterrestrial, interstellar. It's been out there since I forget when they published it, but nobody could organize the resources on a short time frame. And do you know how much it takes to actually mount $1 million expedition to the deep sea?
It was a million and a half, but he got it out of the working funds of Harvard.
Well, that's what he claimed.
I heard him.
Yeah, we don't know. That's what he's claiming.
Why would he lie? That's easy.
Because these guys lie getting up in the morning and going to bed at night. Come on, it's second nature. You don't rise to that level without lying. Look at Carl. Carl was a double agent, selling me one thing and telling the public another thing, et cetera, et cetera. So look, I'm politically choosing Loeb to be the point person, because if he has a personal stake at being immortal in history, this will give it to him. If he's running on short orders, we will find out. If it's not him, it will be somebody else, but I would open the hailing frequencies to Loeb first, because he has positioned himself on the runway to be this kind of person doing this kind of thing and making this kind of discovery.
Well, so my point is you should always have a second opinion. I just don't trust having Avi Loeb have the first and only first take on the analysis. I think there should be someone else simultaneously who's qualified.
Can I suggest somebody?
Yes, Laura.
I don't know. I could be way off, but I'd like to bring up once again, I know I've mentioned him many times, but Farouk Elbaz, who is a professor at Boston University. He is an archaeologist, and he runs the Center for Remote Sensing.
He used to
work for NASA.
Yeah, well, he was called in the astronaut corps the king, which was a English version of Pharaoh, because he's Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
Farouk Elbaz picked ultimately all the landing sites for every Apollo mission.
Mm-hmm.
He was head of that team.
Could we hear the rest of what Laura was trying to say?
No, that's what I was trying to say, because earlier Richard said everybody pick someone, and I had contacted him, his assistant, a couple years ago, a few years ago. I was trying to book him for the show, and then I never followed up with it because she said he had a new book coming out. I need to find out if he came out with that new book. Doesn't matter. But what is it the case that because he's an academic, he's not going to be open to this sort of thing? I mean, this Center for Remote Sensing promotes the use, it says, of space technology in the fields of archaeology, geography, and geology.
Well, Farouk Elbaz, who I've been following ever since I was, you know, part of CBS and Apollo and all that way back then, he not only picked the landing sites, but after the landings, after the Apollo program closed, he would give interviews to Argosy magazine or Omni or whatever public outlet, and he would hint so precisely as Emily Dickinson that there was a lot more about the lunar missions that was not yet ready to tell. Like, he's been sitting on the secrets for 50 years. He might be willing now to, because it's permission time, he might be willing to go the next step, given that there's a physical set of objects that can be analyzed, no opinions, straight science, they're machines.
Why not do a petition, Laura, at change.org to get Avi Loeb to look at it? So if you get enough people signing a petition to get Avi Loeb to look at this.
Yeah, I'm on the side of not trusting Dr. Loeb. I don't know. There's just something a little shady about him, but I'm going after Elbaz.
We all agree. Like, the point is that sometimes politics makes weird bedfellows. Given Loeb's position, given what he claims he wants to do, if we offer him the opportunity and he says, "I'm not associating with you ruffians," then we'll know. If he takes the information and it disappears and a paper appears in a year with his name on it and nobody else's, well, no more. The point is, it's no single point failure. I only bring him up with a challenge because he is the most visible point person who claims on the record this is what he wants to do.
I'd like to say something about this.
Wait a second, Robert. Hold on.
Go ahead.
We've been having a pretty inflammatory conversation about Loeb. I don't know that we should send this show now unless we send him an edited show file.
I think I can counteract it. Go ahead. I think I can counteract what's been said, Cynthia, because I kind of like him.
Well, but that doesn't discount all the conversation that's gone on.
Yeah, but Cynthia, if I may say, when you reach Loeb's level, you are light years past like and, you know, being liked and not being thin-skinned and all that. He's had a million horrible things said about him. All we've said tonight is that the proof will be, quoting my grandmother, in the pudding. If we offer him the opportunity and he turns it down, it means he's not as smart as he thinks he is.
Well, I think you should re-listen to this before you say what you're saying.
Well, does Loeb trust himself as an associate researcher? And maybe there's a community of researchers that he...
Well, he's made himself all part of the UAP conversation. Kind of like... Go ahead.
He only invited certain people to be part of this Galileo project. So all of those people he's got.
She's right. And he put that together in response to the fact that he was getting heat from his bosses at Harvard. Because since he's tenured, they couldn't fire him, but they wanted to. And that was all before it was, you know, he had made very much noise.
Do we know, Ron, whether he was fired from the directorship of the observatory at Harvard or he decided to resign and devote time to this?
All I know is he has tenure. They can't fire him.
Yeah, but
would have applied to that. But he lost his
directorship of the observatory, which was his key professionally into astrophysics, space science, et cetera, and why he got involved in the Oumuamua thing in the first place, given it was discovered by a telescope in Hawaii first.
Well, all I can say is I'm pretty good at analyzing people when I listen to them. And when I heard him, you know, do another show last week, I was impressed. I was all prepared to not be. You know, I went in with my hackles up already. And I thought, okay, he sounds solid to me. Yes, he's running an agenda, but I don't think we should discount him just because he already has connections.
Well, I'm not saying... Go ahead,
Robert. My comment on Loeb is if you want him to do what you want, contact the government of Israel because that's who controls him.
Oh, see what I mean? This doesn't help, Robert.
No, well, facts are facts.
If you want to help from somebody, you try and be nice about them. There's no reason. No reason to try and paint them with a stain.
Well,
sense.
Ron, let me kind of recontext that. We're not asking him for help. I'm asking him to take over the damn thing and do it. If he decides if he decides not to, it will be for his own reasons that have nothing to do with whether we like him or don't like him or are suspicious or not suspicious. We are light years beyond like. That's not what runs this secret government. Like is
what
not
was the
part
title
of
this episode? The Avi Loeb Challenge?
Yeah, well, the challenge is you step up to an opportunity.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. You weren't challenging. You're not challenging him to do a duel with muskets.
No. Nope.
You know, you're saying, will you add this to your catalog of information and
see? It's so easy if you're in the club and he's in the club, and he's got the staff. He had 20 people that helped him analyze the damn meteorite from the bottom of the Pacific.
He has the permission.
And he's already broken ground. He's already in public. He's already leading. All he has to do is add this to his sample size and the benefits to Loeb personally in human history are incalculable if ego plays a part in science, which it does.
Yeah, it certainly does in professorship, and yet I would have signed up for his classes.
The thing is, Richard, I think Ron nailed it. I know there's only 60 seconds left, and that is – they're deflecting everything away from our solar system. This goes back to 2017 and Representative Dana Rohrabacher when he asked the NASA officials, was there ancient civilizations on Mars? No. And then Rogan was interviewing Musk.
I was just going to say, the conversation with Musk and Rogan where they talked about everything I talk about except they moved it safely 5 light years away.
Yeah, let Andrew finish his sentence.
No, Richard did it. They are pushing it out of the neighborhood. They're afraid of what's in our backyard on the floor.
Yep.
Okay, guys, we are literally at the end of the show. I thank you all for your contributions. I love the fact that everybody sees what's there. The next question, of course, is who is going to bell the cat, which means who is going to approach Loeb, and obviously that's going to be me. So until tomorrow night when we run this all again – I want to thank all my guests tonight, too numerous to mention. They're on the website, detailed biographies. Tonight, their reaction at looking at the inexplicable and seeing what is there is a memory I'm going to take forward into a very uncertain future. So until tomorrow night, we'll hear all this again, but get some more people to listen because they need to hear it first and fresh. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.